Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jean-Marc Doucan, Jean Jamiroquai Le Hangar, Jean Condom, Jean-Pierre Barassi,
Jean-Claude Van Damme,
Jean-Luc
Dupria,
Jean-Luc Godard,
Jean-Michel Jarre,
Now we're talking. That is just a collection of some of the French names you can find if you start Duolingo.
I didn't know where that was going. Only one of those did the theme tune, official theme tune for the 2007 Rugby World Cup.
And we will come back to that in just a moment.
Whoa.
I want to start by saying, hey, is your name Jean anything?
Oui. Je m'appelle Jean Willowin Squidge Guy.
Oui.
Et toi?
Oh, oui. Merci. Je m'appelle. No, I don't know. My French isn't good enough for this. Jean Squidge Robbie, whatever else you want to call me.
By the end of this series, you will know how to say that.
Yes, by the World Cup in France, when Duolingo's caught me up a bit. We'll get there.
I'm still coasting. I will stop coasting at some point on my C and GCSE French, but for the time being, yeah. I'm still coasting.
You're further ahead than I am for having got a 50-day streak at this point.
I am the only person in the history of our family who has a GCSE in language.
It's incredible.
Which, well, no, and you have a GCSE in Spanish, but it is a G.
It's an E. But yeah. Come on. Yeah. Let's not talk it down.
Let me finish. It's GCSE.
That's true.
Yeah. You cut me off.
Yeah, and it's very much, I deliberately chose Spanish because I didn't want to do French. And here I am now having to learn French because I'm going to be in France for 8 weeks.
How many times have you been to Spain?
Three times? Oh, as an adult? I don't know. We went a few times when we were kids.
Yeah, we did.
I haven't been to anywhere Spanish speaking as an adult, but I have been to Belgium. I'm going to France for a very long time. I've been to Canada, which has a heavy French speaking
and heavy English speaking community. But yes, I take.
Yes,
it
yeah. You can get away with only speaking English.
I went to Spain last year, and I'm going to Spain again this year, and I don't really know many words of Spanish.
Mm.
But the thing is, I only had one situation where I was caught out and I was like, oh shit, I just don't know what to do here because I don't know how to order this wrap in Spanish. I was there just kind of freezing on the spot. And then somebody who was American came by and said, do you want me to interpret for you? And I was kind of like, nah, don't worry about it. And I just winged it through the conversation. And basically whatever she asked if I wanted, I was like, yeah, go on then. And then because I just needed to be out there.
You went for a festival, right?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. You had to order the wraps individually. Did you have to order every type of music you wanted, one by one?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was pretty good. I can't remember if I saw any rappers there, to be honest. Unfortunately, I didn't.
So the food just came in nothing?
You're mucking me off here.
You didn't get anything around the food?
It just levitates in Spain, mate. Do you not know?
That's a hell of a revelation and makes so much sense now. Why you always see those flying tortillas.
Yeah, exactly. They were playing, actually. Yeah, they were sub-headlining.
Flying tortillas. Yeah. Yeah, big fan of their album, Floating
They're not very big in the UK, but massive in Spain. Massive floating tortillas.
Huge portion sizes.
Yeah, exactly. This is terrible banter.
It truly is. Should we get back to talking about French classical composers?
Indeed. Let's do it.
So, as you mentioned, for the run of this podcast, because Tom Rosenthal, who recorded our previous theme tunes, was on tour when we were doing this, didn't want to bother him too much, So we have been using, at your Mr. Will Owens discretion, the Jean Will Owen, sorry.
We.
The declared, the decided theme tune for the 2007 Rugby World Cup. Now, I always, every time I listen back to one of them, I think of it very much as the Heineken Cup or the Heineken Champions Cup theme tune. This is kind of how it always is in my head. I don't know if, I think there's probably
think
a lot of people
watching.
That's generational
though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of people listening that probably have the same thing, that are going like, oh, it's the Heineken Cup theme tune. Cool, okay.
It's the official theme tune of 2007 Rugby World Cup. That's why it was written.
Yeah.
Industrial Revolution Part 2. It's a banger.
Yes, it is. It is. That is the name of the track. Now, I thought it was worth us talking about this for a bit, because we've kind of largely ignored it. We are going to talk about Wales against Australia in a bit, but I wanted to talk a bit about the official theme tune for the 2007 Rugby World Cup in this entirely comprehensive guide to the 2007 Rugby World Cup on the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective podcast.
And it's all we will talk about is the rugby and the things surrounding the rugby and nothing else.
Yes. Yeah, it's all we've ever talked about.
Yeah.
So, as you mentioned, this was a piece of music written by Jean-Michel Jarre. Jean-Michel André Jarre, to give him his middle name. What do you know about this particular man?
He's French. I know that much.
Correct. He is born in Lyon, where he grew up.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but his name
with his
is
his parents, who
Jean...
got divorced when he was 10.
I didn't know that. You're spoiling so much for me. So his name is Jean-Michel Jarre. His middle name is André. His parents got divorced when he was 10. He wrote Industrial Revolution Part 2, the official theme song of the 2007 Rugby World Cup, which eventually, fun fact for you, went on to get used for the Heineken Champions Cup theme tune as well.
And nothing else.
I believe at some point, and this is a weird factoid, it might be bollocks. I believe at some point he's played Coachella. I think I've seen him on a lineup there before, because they occasionally get like him and like Hans Zimmer and like, you know, all of the cool composers that all the kids are into, like Jean-Michel Jarre. And also, he was referenced once in an episode of I'm Alan Partridge.
Yeah, I can tell you exclusively, he did indeed. He's played Coachella twice, most recently in 2018.
Okay, that adds up. So he would have probably opened for like Eminem.
Where
or
did Alan Partridge bring him up?
I can't remember, but he definitely has brought up Jean-Michel Jarre. I don't think it was in the context of hosting his radio show.
Fair enough. So Jean-Michel Jarre, right, is one of these people like André Rieu, who is inexplicably absolutely enormous all over the world.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a bit of an anecdote about André Rieu.
Please do. Please tell me.
So, oh my God, I've just realised that I'm opening a whole can of worms by telling this anecdote. So, you sort of know about this, but I've not... Go on.
For anyone unaware, André Rieu is a Dutch violinist who is massive.
He's massive.
He's one of the biggest musical stars in the world.
Yeah.
But no one under 50 has heard of it.
Yeah. Like, he could play anywhere on the planet and he'd play, like, arena-like level shows.
Yeah.
Not like stadiums, but like arenas, like solidly anywhere.
He's to the level of fame that virtually every live gig he does gets, like, simulcast in cinemas.
Wow. That's insane.
Like, he's that level of famous.
He's playing Nottingham Arena,
like,
this month.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. But, like, he will sell out arena tours and then have millions of people going to watch it in cinemas.
And, like,
live.
So many people just don't know about it. Like,
yeah. Like, he just flies over the heads of anyone under 50.
Sure. So, my weird anecdote about André Rieu stems from the fact that, and this is a revelation to anybody who's listened to like 100 episodes of this podcast, so me and my good friend Jacob, after a couple of beers in about 2018, before we went and saw Paul McCartney, we went and made loads of beer-based, like, Beatles puns, like song titles and stuff, and then we decided we're going to turn this into an actual band, and so we did. The Beatles, with their album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Pub Band.
Nice.
Which is like 90% done. I think there's like two tracks we need to finish off. But that's the thing, that we started for a laugh. We're not going to play live or anything. We just thought we'd record those tracks whilst drunk and kind of decide. You know, we've got a few, you know, solid tracks in there. We've got Something in the Way She Brews. We've got Getting Bitter. We've got Oh Carling. You know, and the title track, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Pub Band, of course. So we had an Instagram account made for that, where essentially we just both shitpost and diss Ringo Starr on there. And at one point, one of us will have put like a joking comment shitposting on Paul McCartney's page, and we got a message from an account that was called Paul McCartney, but obviously it was Paul McCartney. Like, nobody would name themselves Paul McCartney on Instagram, and his profile picture was a photo of Paul McCartney. So it's like, oh my god, Paul McCartney's private account is messaging us saying, hello, I'm Paul McCartney, obviously. Just wanted to reach out to you because you're a good, loyal fan. And I'm really grateful for you, and I'd like to get to know you. What is your name? And so we just responded saying, like, some kind of stupid name.
Keith.
Keith's the
stupidest name in the world.
Yeah, apparently so.
There's no one called Keith that isn't stupid.
Keith. That's a terrible thing to say.
Take that, Keith Jarrett.
No context, Squid Rugby. But anyway, so we decided, you know what, let's entertain Paul McCartney on the other end of this conversation, because hey, he was in the Beatles. Like, he's a huge star, is Paul McCartney.
I've heard of him.
We got really into this conversation with Paul McCartney and really humouring everything he has to say, and then at one point he asks, like, oh yeah, have you got Telecast or whatever it is, Telegram maybe, whatever it is they try and get you to go on to give them money, essentially, right? And he said, okay, here's a challenge for you. I'm currently having a bet with a good friend of mine. And we said, okay, who's the good friend of yours? And he said, Woody Harrelson. I'm having a bet with Woody Harrelson. And I was like, okay, what's the bet?
Boring random example.
And then he said, the bet is that he bets that I can't get one of my fans to pay me £50 in the form of an Amazon voucher. And so what we did was we then responded saying, like, oh, Paul, we'll do that for you. Like, we're really loyal fans of yours. Like, you encouraged us, inspired us to start this band about beer. Like, of course we're going to do this for you. Here's the link to the Amazon voucher that we've just redeemed for you. And it was like spotify.com/presaveocarling by the Beatles.
Nice.
And he was there saying, like, the link doesn't seem to work. It seems to send me to Spotify. Could you do something else? And at this point, I'd gone to training. So I'd missed this message.
For rugby?
For rugby, yes.
Holy
rugby.
Shit, yeah. You like rugby?
Yes, we'll get into that. And then when I came back from training, I saw I had a message on Instagram to that account from Andre Ryu, and I was like, wait, what? And the guy had changed his name on Instagram to Andre Ryu to try and scam someone else. And so we then had a long conversation about how he's now Andre Ryu, and then basically another Paul McCartney account messaged us with exactly the same shtick, not exactly the same, but a similar shtick, trying to go for that. And then basically we managed to turn the tables back on him because he was so desperate, and we said, look, I won't block your account if you change your name and profile picture to Andre Ryu. And then we got him to do it, and he did. And then we blocked him because he tried calling us. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And to be fair, I did pick up for about 5 seconds.
Did you give him his note?
No. You can call someone on Instagram.
Oh, okay.
No. Oh, Christ, no. I didn't get my number. Although that would have been a really good bit of commitment to the bit, but no.
Yeah.
No, so it turned out it wasn't Andre Ryu.
I can't believe that Andre Ryu is trying to scam people into thinking he was Paul McCartney.
Yeah, but it's mad that people are trying to scam people as Andre Ryu. Like,
yeah, scams target old people because they're not internet savvy.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. So that's an ideal person to go for.
Yeah.
Andre Ryu.
Yeah, and people called Beatles UK.
So this is what we're going to keep an eye out for, right? Has anyone as Jean-Michel Jarre tried to scam anyone?
It's probably
and
happened.
If not, I think it'd be great if someone tried to scam Israel Folau as Jean-Michel Jarre.
I heard he's a big fan. He probably watched the 2007 Rugby World Cup.
Anyone who watched the Scottish Rugby Pod's Doddmaster knows I have form of creating fake accounts to slide into Israel Folau's DMs. And maybe this is time. Maybe it's time that Jean-Michel Jarre.
And real accounts.
And my own account got blocked by him without me saying anything.
Yeah.
He just one day searched for me and blocked me out because he hates me, and it's a badge of honour, you know? Normally I'm not for that, but Israel Folau's a special case.
Yeah.
So, Jean-Michel Jarre, right?
Yes.
He is absolutely enormous.
Yeah.
Right? He is 9 foot tall. he is one of the biggest artists in the world.
Mm.
In fact, there's an argument to be made that he is the biggest artist in the world.
Oh, okay. Wow.
What's the biggest gig you've ever been to in terms of, like, number of people there?
Kylie Minogue at Glastonbury.
That's pretty sizable.
There was,
sizable.
Like, a good, like, 150,000, I'd guess, people there.
Oh, wow.
Like, it is, I think, the second biggest crowd in Glastonbury history, I think. It's certainly the biggest crowd for a legend slot.
Mm, that is huge.
Yeah.
Do you know roughly how many people were there?
At Glastonbury, the capacity is about 200,000, and I'd say that they probably had about 150,000. They had to tactically schedule, they put Bring Me the Horizon on opposite because they knew the crowd would be that massive. Like,
wow, okay.
They had to accept like an early slot, like just to drag people away.
That's a miserable point for your own career.
It is, yeah. They had to request it wasn't televised, Bring Me the Horizon.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Jean-Michel Jarre.
Yes.
Jointly owns, he is tied for first place for the biggest attendance at a concert ever.
Wow.
In world history.
Jesus.
Him and Rod Stewart hold the record joint.
Okay, okay.
Rod Stewart's infamous gig on Copacabana Beach in Rio de Janeiro on New Year's Eve in 94. Right? 3.5 million people is credited as, which is legitimately insane. That's
too many.
That's, I would say, Jean-Michel Jarre tied that in Moscow.
Wow.
For the 850th anniversary of Moscow. I did a big shrug. He was invited to perform and he broke the world record, right? However, it was at that point, Rod Stewart had just broken his own record, but he held that record then as well, before that.
Okay.
So he has at four different points in his life broken records for the biggest ever crowd.
Wow.
He did it first in 1979, where he had a million people come to a gig on Bastille Day in Paris. He then, a few years later, did one in Houston, which had 1.3 million. Then 2.5 million Bastille Day a few years later. And then the one in Moscow.
Wow.
He is huge.
Yeah, yeah. What year was the last time he broke the record?
1997.
Oh, so it was before he released Industrial Revolution Part 2.
It wasn't.
Was it not?
So the theme he wrote for this World Cup, Industrial Revolution Part 2, was released on an album called Revolutions.
Okay, yeah.
In 1987.
Oh, okay.
The year of the first Rugby World Cup.
Yeah. Maybe he was inspired by Superboot.
Wait, no, sorry. Yeah, he recorded it in 1987. He released it in 1998.
Okay.
No, 1988. So I think it was. I think he was clearly largely inspired by that French team, by Serge Blanco's imaginary ball, and by Superboot.
Yeah. Big, big fan of Jean-Jamiroquai Lahangar, Patrice Lebon.
Yes.
And all of the other heroes of that team.
The gang. The whole gang together. You know, he had a track on it called Tokyo Kid and one called London Kid.
Mm.
And those were clearly inspired by Mike Harrison of Wakefield, who he got confused about. And we're looking at, Miyamoto, the flanker?
Yeah. Seiji Hirao.
There's also a track called September, which I think is clearly where they, A, massively inspired Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah.
But B, inspired them to move the Rugby World Cup to later, because that first World Cup was played in, like, May.
Yeah, they do heavily structure.
Moved back September.
They do heavily structure the Rugby World Cup around Jean-Michel Bouchard's schedule and song names.
There's also a track on that album called Computer Weekend, which is entirely what they based the Super Saturday on.
Okay, yeah.
It was entirely the one of the Computer Weekend.
Yeah,
so they played all the games back to back.
I just had a look
so they could
now.
Have a Computer Weekend.
There's also a song on there called Last Round of the Pool Stages.
And,
I'll give that a listen after we're finished. It sounds quite good.
Oh, it's very, very good.
Yeah. The Irish semi-final, that one never made it onto the album.
He wrote this in the 80s. Mm-hmm. He released it in the 80s. He then, for the Rugby World Cup in 2007, re-recorded it with the Prague Philharmonic. And he did an orchestral version, a new rearrangement of a classic track, which he put together as a lazier way because he was asked to write a new song for it. But he's French and he went, I'll just do one of my old ones, but new. And so he did a new arrangement of a classic song that he had written. And I'll tell you what, I went back and listened today to the originals from the 80s.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I bet it is. I bet it is.
It's like, but because you hear that song that we all know is that kind of epic intro. So John Schmidt talked about after, looking back on this World Cup, how much he loved that song.
Oh,
how much
yes.
he loved coming out to it and how much it really pumped him
Did
up.
Did he refer
really
to it
going.
At any point as a fucking banger?
No.
If so, I agree
with him. Special.
Okay.
Which is close enough.
Yeah,
that's all right.
I interpret it as a very special song. Yeah.
He said that a few years later, like after that World Cup in 2007, it was at around like 2015, 16, he was in a hotel and he went down to the bar and had a drink. And they had someone, you know, pianist, as they do in posh hotels.
Yeah, they had
someone at the piano just playing. And they started playing that, you know, his kind of rearrangement of Industrial Revolution Part 2. And he said that immediately on hearing that song again, he got kind of pumped up and was like back in the mindset of he's about to run out onto the field.
Because they play it, as the teams are coming out. Yeah, yeah.
Which is the thing, it's so dramatic. Yeah, it's played as the run-on music for every team, as well as being the kind of theme tune that played in a lot of the promo stuff.
That's it. And you compare that, like, in 1987, as the team's running out, through the stadium they played, "Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to..."
Very bold choice.
Yeah, they played that Tom Rosenthal song. And, like, don't get me wrong, it's a really good song, but I don't think it exactly screams getting pumped up for a test match to me. And that's why a lot of the rugby was lower quality.
Hotel bar and instantly that coming on.
Yeah.
And that throwing you and changing your mindset immediately into, "I'm about to run out."
It's cool that he got into it. That he was like, "No, this helps." You know?
Yeah. And I reckon there's probably more examples and stories from players out there
who
this World Cup was particularly memorable.
Definitely. I'd love to know more about that. That's incredible.
But, so it's obviously this very grand, sweeping orchestral piece of music, right? The original is not that. Because you hear it's called Industrial Revolution Part 2 and you go, "What?" Why is it called Industrial Revolution Part 2? And then you listen to Part 1, right? Which there is. There's Part 1, 2 and 3 on the album.
Okay.
There's a kind of overture opening and then there's three parts of Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
Part 1, they're all very distinct songs, they don't bleed into each other. But you can tell there is a story being told through them.
Okay.
Part 1 is very like dour and, you know, kind of down and whatever.
Mm, that's England winning 2003 World Cup then.
Yes. Then Part 2, right? The thing that we don't hear in his rearrangement, where it's far more orchestral, is the sheer amount of like electronic sounds and like beeping and booping in there.
Okay.
And it's really cool. It's a really cool little arrangement and completely different. Sounds completely different to the version he did with the Prague Philharmonic. It's well worth going and looking up and putting in.
Yeah.
Like it's a really interesting change and he did fundamentally change the song and it works very differently in very different ways for both.
If not for the fact that we're 20 minutes into the podcast and haven't mentioned the game yet, I would suggest we go and listen to it now, but maybe we'll do that another game, another episode.
Yeah. But I don't know, I thought it was worth looking at
absolutely.
The theme song, you know, because I think it's a really important part of this.
It's iconic. Yeah, I absolutely love it. And like, I get that thing with John Smith that John Smith said, like, as a viewer, of like, I hear that and like, I get like the goosebumps of like, oh yeah, this is going to be good. This is going to be a big game we're about to watch here. Like, this maybe, is, you know, gets you pumped.
But you get why, when you listen to that version, why it's called Industrial Revolution Part 2.
Yes, yes. Okay, fair enough.
It's a very, very different tone and vibe, but it's,
I look
it's
forward
very
to
good,
that.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's exciting. I like it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we should probably, I guess, move along, though there's plenty you can talk about with Jean-Michel Jarre, and plenty we have.
Yes, yes. I enjoyed that. Thank you for that, you know, long introduction to Jean-Michel Jarre.
So the game we are here to talk about eventually today.
25 minutes in.
Yeah, but it's been productive.
It has.
We talked about rugby. It hasn't been that we've just gone, "Oh, broccoli. Oh, do you like broccoli?"
We haven't mentioned
bollocks.
Rugby once, but yes, okay. We have mentioned
We mentioned John Schmidt.
Yeah, that's
you know,
true.
It's rugby, isn't it?
That's true. Carry on. It is productive, though. I agree with that.
is...
We should talk about broccoli, though.
We should talk about broccoli. I agree that it's bollocks with your thoughts. So, Australia's 32-20 win over Wales at the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff.
Yeah.
This is an important game for many reasons, and all of them are that Steve Walsh was the referee.
Right. I was astounded at first when I saw that. I was like, wait a minute. It says Steve Walsh, New Zealand? I think we all know what's gone on here.
Because Steve Walsh, for anyone unaware, referee that was frequently described as controversial.
Divisive, yes.
Yes. Also described as bloody gorgeous.
Yes, handsome, charismatic. Look, all I'll say about Steve Walsh is, he who controls himself controls the game.
Which was a term he had tattooed on himself.
Yes.
He was an incredibly handsome man who was a referee, refereed in 2003 World Cup, in 2007, went on to referee in the 2011 World Cup, but for the Australian Rugby Union. Because shortly after this World Cup, he got incredibly drunk after a Super Rugby game, went on a huge night out, and got sacked right ahead of refereeing a game in the Six Nations.
What a guy. You see, we need more referees like this.
He was due to be handling the Ireland Grand Slam match in 2009 in Cardiff.
Yeah.
Very well-remembered game, the Rowan Lagara drop goal. It was supposed to be Steve Walsh awarding that. That could have been a very, very different game. However, a few days before that, or about a week beforehand, Steve Walsh got himself fired for antics on a night out, which was his third strike by the NZRU.
He was very, like, unconventional as a referee. Like, he, along with Wayne Barnes, they are the only two referees I've ever heard swear on a rugby field, like professional referees. Yeah. And both times I've heard Wayne Barnes do it, he's been quoting what somebody has said to him as abuse. Whereas I've heard Steve Walsh drop F-bombs on a rugby field before. So have you. Like, he's just great. I just love him.
Mm.
The thing is, like, he's not a great referee, but he's so personable with the players that and, like, so empathetic that you kind of just have no choice but to love him. And Steve Rules is a term that we have used on this podcast before. I wouldn't say we coined it. I think it's been a thing for a while. But Steve Rules are completely irrelevant to what the rugby law book states, and that's fine.
Yes. His first strike was in the 2003 World Cup, and we'll cover this eventually.
Okay.
But he started a fight with England's fitness coach. His second strike was during the 2005 Lions tour. The referee got banned for verbally abusing a player. Shane Horgan. He picked a fight with Shane Horgan. And then his third strike was for antics on a night out, which I can't...
What did he say to Shane Horgan? Do we know?
I've got no idea. Oh. We'll have to, one day when we, if we do another Lions Tour series, we'll have to try and do it. We should do the Steve Walsh retrospective.
We should. Let's add that.
Just
to
focus
the queue.
On that.
Let's add that to the queue. We'll cover every game Steve Walsh has ever refereed that there is access to online. I just love the thought that, like, he said, like, 14, just called over Shane Horgan and called him a cunt or something. I love that thought.
As I said, there's a reason he was described as controversial. When he was terminated by the NZRU, another official who had refereed with him, who insisted on anonymity, told The Independent, "The NZRU have clearly run out of patience with Steve. He was a walking time bomb, and it looks as though he's thrown it all away. The sad thing is, he doesn't appear to have anything much except for refereeing in his life.
Ooh.
It seems crazy that he's thrown it away."
I'll have you know he's gone into business these days. He seems to be killing it at business. He loves business.
He must be. He's all over business.
Yeah.
He's so good at business.
Steve Walsh loves business.
Yes. So the final strike was he went to a referee's training course and turned up really drunk. And we have no idea what he did at that course.
I imagine those things are quite hard to get through, you know.
Yep.
I imagine that they're long days. So if he brought a hip flask with him, then I do not begrudge him of that. Yeah.
However, he originally moved to Japan to try and reclaim and requalify as a Japanese referee. That didn't go well. I've got no idea what happened there and why he went for Australia instead.
Yeah.
But he did. He requalified and went to the 2011 World Cup as an Australian official.
Yeah.
But was refereeing Australia here.
Yeah, that's the thing though, because like, you or I could qualify as an RFU English referee, an referee internationally, Wales. You know,
Luke Pearce has.
Luke Pearce has.
I've met Luke Pearce's mum, and she is unbelievably Welsh.
Yeah, Andy Brace, born in Cardiff. Like, yeah. You get it. And look, I'm not questioning the integrity of these people because they're actually good referees.
No, they're brilliant. They're very good at their job.
They're absolutely brilliant and completely unbiased. But if I was to referee international level, I would obviously be biased to Wales. I support them.
Yeah.
And if that ever happens, somebody's going to dig up this podcast and go, oh, that's proof. The IRB is corrupt. I'm localising it, calling it the IRB, because we're covering 2007.
Yes. Yeah. So Steve Walsh runs out. He is the referee. He is here. It took me a moment to adjust the fact he was allowed to referee Australia, but at this point, he had no idea he was going to be Australian in a few years' time.
The thing is, his accent is so clearly Australian. To me, anyway.
So, this game, they run out at the Millennium Stadium, which, of course, the World Cup was in France. This was part of a deal in order to get Wales and Scotland to vote for them. They gave them a couple of games each. It's all political bollocks. We covered it in the first couple of episodes. Yeah. But the thing that I found really funny is that because this World Cup is in France, yet the game is in Wales, they do all the stadium announcements in French first.
And did you see, when the players are in the tunnel, they've got Coupe du Monde written on the walls in Cardiff? And like, I had a moment, like, I had to scroll down on the video and see in the description that it was in Cardiff. So I was like, where are we playing this game? Like, I don't know. Like, obviously I recognise that Millennium Stadium pitch, but I was like, well, I've gotten Coupe du Monde written. I've got everything written up in French around the stadium. Like, all the advertisements, or a lot of the advertisements are in French. As you say, like, the stadium announcement had to be done in French, then English, then Welsh. Like, it was bizarre.
Yeah, they just had to try and pretend that Cardiff is French now. They're like, ah, yes, how do you do, fellow French people?
Yeah, yeah, Cardiff has removed to France.
You step off onto Prunes Street. I went to Google that's Edinburgh, isn't it?
What am I thinking of? Westgate Street.
Westgate Street. Hold on. I'm going to need to type this in again. Westgate Street. Rue de Port-Oust.
Very nicely done.
Thank you. That was smooth.
So, yeah. Wales playing Australia in Cardiff. Mm. Very strange vibe to this. Like, atmosphere was really good, to be fair. But
yeah.
I think that mostly the crowd were very confused about whether or not they were in France.
Yeah, I talked about this again on a previous episode, but there'd been a huge controversy in Wales over how expensive the tickets were for this game in particular.
Okay, yeah.
They were the highest prices that had ever been charged at the Millennium Stadium for rugby tickets.
Wow.
Or for sporting tickets in general.
Right.
For this game. They were, on average, about 70% higher than when Wales had played Australia in the autumn the year beforehand. Hence why I think there are some empty seats.
Yeah.
Because the tickets were so expensive, and they're all groups on the halfway line. So it's either that or it's corporate seats, which is always a problem at Rugby World Cups. There's a lot of tickets get given to corporate sponsors and they don't turn up.
Yeah.
Which is a huge problem that needs to be something done about, hopefully, ahead of this World Cup.
Yeah.
Because it was still an issue in 2019.
Yeah.
That all of the actual seats that are available got sold out, pretty much. I think there was two games that didn't sell out in the last World Cup, and they had like maybe 100 or 200 seats left at most, but they had huge corporate sponsor sections that were unfulfilled. On one of the worst days of my life, worst mornings of my life, most stressful, which I'll talk about another time.
Yeah.
I had to get from one side of Japan to the other in order to see France v Tonga, and I did not have enough time to get there. And I ended up just sitting in a bunch of corporate seats that were untaken, and then Steve Maffey kicked me in the leg. Yes, so should we look at the Welsh team?
Yeah, go on then.
As the home team in a World Cup.
So, this Wales team, I don't want to kind of like hyperbolise this or anything.
Mm.
I would describe them as fine.
Yes.
This is a fine Welsh team.
I look at that Welsh team and I can both understand why they get knocked out in the group stage and why Warren Gatland turns them into Six Nations winners the following season.
I get why this team is selected, right?
Mm.
And I don't necessarily think I would have selected the team any different. But I don't look at that and go like, fuck yeah, you're beating the Springboks.
Exactly. No, you've got a problem there. Gareth Jenkins as coach, though, anything's possible.
That's true, especially in the car park.
So we have Gareth Thomas comes back in as captain.
Yes.
He comes in at fullback, which is kind of the one really big change from the game against
that
Canada.
And Stephen Jones starts. So those were the two who kind of turned the game off the bench against Canada when they'd had that horrific first half. These two came on and there was a little sense of leadership suddenly on the field when those two were suddenly a part of what was suddenly a part of Wales' attack in particular. So yeah, those two are huge changes for Wales.
Mm. Sonny Parker keeps his place at 12, which is kind of the one position where if you're looking at this as someone who isn't a diehard Welsh fan, you kind of go, okay, Geoffrey Jenkins, Matthew Rhys-Addon-Jones, I remember them as a unit in the front row. You know, Alan Wynne-Jones is still going. Martin Williams is an absolute legend who, if you were watching rugby at this time, you definitely remember.
Yeah.
But he's kind of been overshadowed a bit by Sam Warburton since.
Yes.
Because he was, at the time, probably Wales' second best seven of all time. And then Sam Warburton comes along and is the best.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting as well with Martin Williams. Like, he was always kind of top three or four sevens in the world, but never number one because he played at the same time as Richard McCaw.
And George Smith.
Yeah, George Smith, a little bit David Pocock, like Heinrich Brosseau. Like, there's Doucetoire and Bonaire. Like, there's a lot of names who cropped up and just leapfrogged him. But he was always in that, top sort of four or so sevens in the world. But never Richard quite Hill. Conquered top spot. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, just great player. We've talked about him in bits on hit in the past. I loved him. He was good at nothing except cheating, and that was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
He was one of the best cheating open sides you'll ever see, and that was what he built his career on.
That's it.
He was phenomenal at getting away with cheating. His handling was very good, and his kind of support work was very good.
Anything that required being jammy.
He was extremely old school.
He was so, so jammy. But you're right, like, he was physically a long way off the likes of McCaw.
He would not happen nowadays, you know. He was a professional, international open side flanker who was just about 6'4" and just about 15 stone.
Yeah. Yeah. That 15 stone is so light for a back row forward. Like, that would not happen now. He would be shifted into the backs probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
At most be told, put on a load of weight and you can play hooker. But
yeah. Or he'd just be stuck playing regional rugby.
Yeah.
He'd be a Nick Cudd.
Yes. Yes. Which there's no problem with.
No.
It's a good thing.
No.
But yes, I 100% agree with you on that. Yeah, back row of Martin Williams, Colin Chavis and Jonathan Thomas. Jonathan Thomas, interestingly, starting at 8 instead of Chavis, who's starting on the flank.
Mm.
And don't get me wrong, Jonathan Thomas, by all means, seems pretty good in this World Cup. Like, I think he was pretty good against Canada, and I think he was actually decent in this game, Jonathan Thomas. But he's one of those players that when I first started watching rugby, I didn't really see the value of as much as I maybe should have. I always thought, oh yeah, he's pretty good.
But I
kind of just saw his skill, his strength is just, oh, he just plays a load of positions equally well.
Yes, exactly. He played anywhere between 4 and 8. He was a good line-out forward for a back rower type deal. He was one of those who's just like a good all-rounder.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you can see what he brings to the team, can't you? Like,
150-odd caps. He's now the breakdown coach for the Welsh national team.
Yeah.
Which probably explains a lot. When you see how they're playing in this game at the breakdown compared to how it's going nowadays. But yeah, you know, it's a solid Welsh team.
Yeah.
It makes some changes on the bench. You know, there's a few rugby players on there.
You're telling me.
But, you know, it's an okay team.
Yes.
Still weird seeing number 18 being a number 8. Because they have Michael Owen covering there. But there we go. So, the Australia team, on the other hand, is good. I would go as far as saying.
Yes, I would definitely agree that it's good. Bloody good backline they've got out.
Mm.
George Gregan, as we've discussed before, is in the latter days of his career here. But still pretty damn good. Beric Barnes makes his first start for Australia here, having his first cap last week against Japan.
They dropped Stephen Larkin for him.
That's bloody hell, they
impression
do.
He made.
I completely forgot about that. Game. And Larkin was good in the previous game.
Yeah. And they drop him for Barnes. That's how well Barnes played off the bench against Japan. Against a Japan team who by that point were already 50 plus points down.
Yeah. Larkin didn't even get a look in on the bench.
Nope.
Wow.
He drops out entirely, Stephen Larkham. Drew Mitchell also comes in on the wing. That's the other change in the back line. Comes in for Adam Ashley Cooper. But otherwise, you've got Chris Latham. You've got Matt Gitto at 12. You've got Lottie Tecuri and George Gregan.
A Sterling Bullock as captain as well. Like,
yes, of course.
That entire back line is insane. Especially the form Beric Barnes is on here. Like, yeah, it's ridiculous back line. It's overpowered.
Mm. The one other change in the team is Guy Shepherdson comes in at tight head.
Right, okay, so yes or no, have you heard of him?
No.
No, me neither. So I did a bit of research into Guy Shepherdson.
Mm.
I googled his name. That was the start of my research. That's on extensive. Dan Jefferson.
You're almost at my levels with Jean-Michel Jarre.
Yeah. So Google, for context, is a search website where you can type something in and it tells you something about them. It gives you relevant web pages. So I went on there and typed in Guy Shepherdson. And I saw an article which Google claimed was from 2 weeks ago saying, Brumby's Guy Shepherdson, destined for greatness, says Bill Young. And I thought, what?
Is it as a coach or something?
Well, I'll get on to this. I've kind of figured out what's going on, but it says statistically the Brumbies had the worst scrum in the Super 14 last year, which makes it especially courageous for scrummaging coach Bill Young to predict Guy Shepherdson will finish the year as Australia's number one tight head. Admittedly, he's been there before, and then explains what's happened in the 2007
he has been there before
Rugby World Cup, and says he seems to have been hung out a little bit to dry. But hopefully he can get back in the Wallabies squad. He doesn't have his sights set on that at the moment. And I went on his Wikipedia page, like, he's 41.
Yeah.
And ended up at Southern Districts RFC. Then realised it was an error from Google to update this page. Clearly somebody's edited this article or something in the last 2 weeks. Or something on this page. But it shows up as being 2 weeks ago. I don't know. But I had a moment of thinking, is this 41-year-old prop still playing and wanting to oust Angus Bell for the Wallabies number 3 jersey? Not Angus Bell, Alan Aotearoa, Taliatupo. Like, so that was a weird 5 minutes for me, reading that article, and then realising in the small print they've got the word Super 14, and then going, oh, he's not playing Super Rugby AU.
I love the name Guy Shepherdson.
He's Guy Shepherdson.
He's like someone really panicked when they were asked, well, what's your name? And they were like, as they were stood in a field smuggling a sheep. And they're like, Guy Shepherd's son.
Yeah.
Guy Shepherdson, the shepherd's son.
And he's had to run with that and go to a Rugby World Cup with it. His real name's Ben Alexander.
Nobody knew.
But yeah, he comes in. Don't know, who knows about that? Alongside starting Stephen Moore with a little bit of hair, which means not Stephen Moore. Like, that's just not him.
Mm-hmm.
That's someone else.
Yeah. I just can't. It doesn't make sense to me. I can't see Stephen Moore with hair and go, ah, that's Stephen Moore.
No, it's not.
I just go, ah, a man.
It's an imposter. Yes.
A shepherd's son.
Yes, it's Guy Shepherdson playing hooker, the real one. Yeah, elsewhere in their pack, they've got Nathan Sharp and Dan Vickerman in the second row. Rocky Elsom retains his place at blindside. Obviously, very bloody good player. And somebody that we started to wank over in the Australia-Japan episode, and I feel there's going to be a lot more of that to come in this series and other World Cups, George Smith playing on the flank.
Yes.
Woo, he's good, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he makes me do high-pitched voices.
Can I cycle back to Guy Shepherdson?
Go for it, mate. Go for it.
Guy Shepherdson is a double international.
Is he now?
He's played for two different countries, back in an era where that, again, wasn't allowed.
Oh, wait, what?
He played for Indonesia.
Yo.
But Indonesia weren't a recognised nation by the IRB at the time, so he was allowed to play for one that were.
Oh, wow. Wait, so is he from Indonesia, or is he...
He was born in Jakarta in Indonesia.
Oh, wow. So...
His dad was a, like, Australian aid officer, like government aid... would go around a kind of like a charity type deal for deprived areas. So he was born while he was in Indonesia. Guy Shepherdson played for an Indonesian team.
Okay.
As in the national team, a team called Indonesia.
Yeah.
But they weren't allowed to award test cap because they weren't a member of the IRB at the time.
Wow. I take it he was also like actually Australian qualified, so...
Yeah, his parents are Australian.
That was his second choice. Like, his second choice was playing for the Wallabies in a World Cup. But if he had his way, he'd have just played for Indonesia.
Well, he was the first Indonesian to ever play in the World Cup.
That's class. I just love that. Like, he chose Indonesia first, then the Wallabies as his backup plan. That's great.
Yeah. Kind of didn't have the choice of playing for Indonesia in organised competition.
Yeah. It's a shame. That's really good, though. That's really good. That's great that he managed to get a run out for Indonesia, even if it wasn't awarded a test cap.
So, does that bring us through the Australian team?
I reckon it probably does. Bench is
Julian
very
Huxley's on the bench.
Yes,
so
he is.
Just a fun name to say.
Weird era of Julian Huxley playing for the Wallabies.
Weird era, yeah. Generally, because that Wallabies team is either incredibly talented all timer or who?
I think a lot of these players on the bench, I look at and like, this is definitely generational, right? I see a lot of Super Rugby player names on the bench, like Scott Staniforth and Julian Huxley and Stephen Hoyles.
Mark Chisholm, like, a lot of players that I saw playing Super Rugby at the tail end of their career and didn't really get to see in their prime.
Indeed, yes.
So, the actual game itself, they make the announcements, Dans La France, they head out, and it slowly dawns on us that this game has no commentary.
No commentary. I kind of thought beforehand, like, oh, okay, you know, the teams are just running out. It might be one of those that when the first kick is kicked off, they go like, oh, okay, welcome, you join us here, blah, blah, blah.
It's the sort of game they get Martin Gillingham on for.
Yes, exactly.
Like, one where they don't have a build-up and he just has to start talking the moment the kickoff goes.
Yes, yes. And also at one point during the Welsh National Anthem, you just hear the sound of, like, I don't know if it's fuzz or it's water near a microphone. I don't know if someone's pissed on a microphone or what, but very strange. And it drowns out the Welsh anthem for a couple of seconds, and then it comes back.
And it's a good Welsh anthem.
It is. Two good anthems. Two very good anthems.
So I think that there have obviously been, famously, the 2013 England game. Mm. There have been a bunch of Wales games where you go, are the players or the crowd have done an absolute blinder here? I think this is one of the best performances by the choir of the Welsh anthem you'll find.
Yeah.
The choir is singing their heart out and delivering it in such spirit and like genuine, like moved passion.
Yes.
Like almost tearful, the entire.
In France as well.
Entire choir.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, well, they've had a long journey. They're probably jet lagged.
Yeah.
What, it's what, like a 2 hour time difference?
Yeah,
come on.
Something like that. Yeah. But you're right, like really good anthem for both
teams.
They
knock out. Yeah, they knock out the Australian anthem as well.
Yeah.
They do real justice to it.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. And sets up what is bound to be a classic test match.
I'm glad you were there to commentate. It was even more so than our recent episode with Claire Thomas. Really underlined the value of commentary.
Yeah.
Watching this game without. I found myself drifting in and out so much more.
Yes.
And not paying attention to big moments.
That's it.
And when tries came, you're kind of going like, oh, it's just stuff, isn't it? It's just someone's done some stuff.
You have to kind of rewind it a little bit and then kind of focus yourself. Because, like, usually when you watch live sport, if you're, because, like, as with any human, your mind slightly drifts at some stage. You think about something else, then the commentator goes, and now it's Williams. And you go, oh, yes. Mm. And it refocuses you. Like, it keeps you engaged. Whereas there wasn't that. You just had the crowd sound to, like, drift you up, which is consistent.
Or you're in the crowd, and you're therefore automatically more engaged, because that's the one thing you're doing.
Yes.
You know? Like, you have made a decision to go there and focus entirely on this thing for the 80 minutes, the 2 hours, the whatever it is it lasts.
Yes.
Which is a very different thing to sitting and watching it on TV or on your laptop, whatever it is, on my iPad as it was.
Yeah.
And then having to go, oh, okay, I can do other things. You know, I can. At one point, I picked up my Switch and was like, what have I just. And I was like, no, I'm watching this for the podcast.
Yeah. What were you going to play on your Switch?
Oh, so I've been going through Metroid Prime. They just done like a big remaster of it.
Okay.
I probably wasn't going to play that whilst watching it, but that is the game that was in there at the time.
Fair enough.
I probably would have picked it up, thumbed around for a bit, and probably like put Smash Bros. In or something and played that for five minutes.
Fair play. Who's your current main on Smash Bros.? Still Link?
Link's always been my main. Yeah.
Fair play.
Yeah.
Cool. Good chat.
I do like messing around with the DLC characters because I've never used them much. Yeah. And like every now and again when I play it, I'll be like, oh, I should probably learn these guys.
Yeah, fair enough. Isn't there like a billion characters in Super Smash now?
Yeah, there's like 80 players now. Wow. 80 characters now.
Wow.
It's ridiculous.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Is Beric Bonds on there yet?
He's a me.
I see, yeah. I hope you have Beric Bonds down on there as a me.
I've got Warren Gatland as a me.
That's pretty good. I'm pretty sure it's illegal to have like a Wii or a Switch or whatever and not make a me of Barack Obama. I'm pretty sure that's illegal.
Well, I think the me fighters I have on Smash Bros. Are Warren Gatland, Nick Clegg,
okay.
Claudia Winkleman, and someone else.
Okay. That's pretty good. I'd probably play as someone else. Or Gatland.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But it was just, you know, it's a good combination of people, and I think they should have a dinner party together, and we should get notes.
Yes. What I'm noticing is we have the opportunity to provide the internet's only commentary on this game, and we are squandering it.
I'll tell you what, right? There's almost no internet talk on Super Smash Bros. Out there.
That's true. It's true. No one's discussed that. It's sort of niche shit we like to get into on this podcast.
You know, there's literally no podcasts, videos on YouTube. Like, there's nothing on YouTube about Super Smash Bros.
Yeah.
Try looking it up. You won't. You'll find one video from Nintendo
However,
that just said, oh, we've bloody added Sonic.
Yeah, exactly.
That was it. That's the only update they've ever made.
Stuff about Wales 20, Australia 32 from 2007. So much of it.
Overwhelming. People are constantly speculating what players are going to put in it next.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. There was a point by the end of the game where each team had 24 players. It's
do you remember
so confusing.
When, do you remember when Gareth Jenkins did updates every single day on things he was going to put in Australia 20?
Like new
tactics 20, Australia 32.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, although, yeah,
that
yeah,
point
yeah.
When,
announcing a player one by one.
That point where Chris Latham used a Pokeball felt like bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. You shouldn't have been allowed to bring that out.
No,
you know,
no,
this
no.
is why I play Wales 20, Australia 32 of items off.
Yeah, that's fair. But like Chris Latham scoring that try with Ho-Oh, like taking him to the try line, which it just felt like it was unfair.
Yeah, and like this is the thing. Like I looked at that stadium, right, and I get they couldn't use the original version from the original game.
Yeah,
but why do they have to make it French in order to fit in with the
right?
themes?
Yeah. It's bizarre. It's just too far. It's too far.
It's too far. It's too far.
Shit graphics.
But, you know, they had great range of songs you could choose from, though.
Yeah.
You know.
Such as Industrial Revolution Part 2.
Exactly. They had actually Industrial Revolution Part 1, but it's far rarer. Like, you've got to play it at a certain time of day and it'll come up.
Yeah. This is bollocks. Let's talk about the game. 10 seconds in, Adam Jones gets penalised for going off his feet at a ruck.
Yeah, Australia kicked the penalty and that's it. It's just like, oh, it's one of those Wales games.
Yeah, where they never lead in the whole test match. Like, not even for a minute.
I would have absolutely hated watching this live.
Yeah, me too. Like, I know we've barely started talking about the game, but the scoreline flat as Wales.
Yeah. Well, Wales are basically... Wales are good for the last 10 minutes.
Mm.
And when Australia have two players sent off.
Yes.
And here's the thing, because I remembered this game, my kind of vague memories of this match. I don't remember watching it live or anything. My vague memories of this match having existed were Australia battered Wales.
Right, okay.
And I remembered it being a much higher score than it was. Or, you know, I remembered it being a much greater difference than 12 points.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
And in my head, it was something like, you know, 38-6 or something.
Yeah.
Like a scoreboard that was really one-sided. And it isn't quite that, but it is bad. And so I spent the first 15 minutes going, this is better for Wales than I was expecting, you know, because they give away that penalty right away. And then not long afterwards, Stephen Jones kicks a penalty to put Wales level. And Wales are sort of in it for about 14 minutes. For like 14 minutes, this is quite an even contest.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that. I mean, I didn't know what the score was or anything like that. I didn't really know anything about this game.
It was 32-20.
Yeah, well done. I didn't really know anything going into this game. Just anything at all about anything, let alone about this game.
Oh, and now you know about Jean-Michel Jarre.
Yeah, so much. I've learned so much in the last hour. But, yeah, the whole time it just... I've seen this Wales game enough times that I just knew how it was going to go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're just going to get slowly and painfully battered, like... Yeah, and you're right, like, we held him out for, like, a good 14 minutes, as you say, but, like, there was one point where Shane Williams got the ball, that was quite good.
I shouted, go on, Shane, out loud.
Yeah, me too.
I forgot it wasn't live.
Yeah, me too, but he did go into touch, so, ultimately, in vain.
Yeah, he went on too far.
Yeah.
Martin Williams does a nice little grubber as well, which is fun.
He does, yeah. I tell you what, though, like, because Wales's kicking game was quite poor in this game, but... Clearly, Gareth Thomas just, like, had the idea of, like, oh, I know exactly what we're going to do, when we're going to kick, and so on. And put in some really, really nice kicks and got some, like, really big, like, net gains for Wales and stuff. But the thing that puzzles me is, like, why didn't he tell Stephen Jones to do that? Or Dwayne Peel?
Something that I thought never comes up is how very solid Gareth Thomas's kicking game is.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everyone talks about
it's
him as
what
being
I'm learning
this kind of, like, strike runner. Him kind of...
Yeah.
You know, he would... really run and play with absolutely everything he was.
Yes.
And it was very much his effort and passion and commitment.
His heart was on his
recommended
sleeve.
Recommended him as a player.
Yes.
Yeah. And in his mouth in the place of teeth.
Yes.
It was, he was a remarkable character. Also, you look at him in this game, like, how was anyone surprised he was gay? Like, the base layer he's wearing, the whole look, like, it's...
Yeah.
There's something... He's just... He drips it, and I love it. I love
yes,
him.
Yes, I love Gareth Thomas.
Wonderful. It's impossible to be Welsh and not love Gareth Thomas.
Absolutely.
All of this,
absolutely.
The fact, and that I know there's obviously stories at the minute that are, you know,
yes, that are controversial and ongoing.
Yes,
but
and I feel they're too much to dive into now.
Correct,
but
on
Alfie
the surface,
the player,
yes,
Alfie the personality and the character.
Yes, I've always loved that he's simultaneously one of Wales's hardest, certainly backs, if not rugby players generally, proportionate to kind of like his body size and everything, and also like an extreme gay icon. I think it's it's genuinely fantastic that those two things like cross over. Obviously, always, you know, grow up a big fan of Gareth Thomas, but as you say, like,
how
go on.
There is no one that flits easier from really hard to really camp, and yeah. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. Big fan of him.
Mm.
And yeah, as you say, like, his kicking game was something I never knew he had until I'm watching this game. It's like, oh my god, like, he has a really good boot on him, and like, tactically, he's so sure of what he's doing. And yeah, makes a few really, really good kicks early on and helps Wales get into good positions.
Yeah, fantastic. He's very good and very big part of that. Wales improving on the start in the previous game where Canada
Correct.
Were better
yes.
than them the whole way through.
Yes.
And I think Stephen Jones is as well. Like, Stephen Jones makes a couple of errors in the second half, but he has a really solid first half.
Yeah. In terms of, like, game management and, like, tactical stuff and, like, knowing about the game, there is no real flaw in Stephen Jones. Like,
no.
I think physically he's not as good a fly-half as a lot of the guys, you know, like a Dan Carter or something, who is much more balanced and quicker and, you know, more agile than Stephen Jones ever was. But in terms of actually pure knowledge of the game, Stephen Jones was just always solid.
Yeah.
Always
his
had the
decision
right
making was excellent. He didn't really make many mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, another player who was both beloved and maligned in Wales because people loved him and people also hated the fact he wasn't Phil Bennett or Barry John.
Yeah. Yeah. That he's kind of the opposite of the kind of fly half that Wales wants to romanticise all the time.
Mm.
Dan Bigger is very much the same as well. Like,
there's also there is something in the fact that Wales, the last few generations, they went from Neil Jenkins to Stephen Jones to Dan Bigger.
Yes,
and you've also got a brief stop off from Reece Brisland, who's different.
Yeah, and James.
But
Hawk.
Really, yeah. When you look back on it and you do those kind of like sweeping montages right through from Cliff Morgan to Barry John to Phil Bennett, etc., to Jiffy, to Neil Jenkins. There are three very conservative fly-halves in a row.
Yes. Yes.
So there's a bit in this game where Shane Williams has the ball and Alan Wynne-Jones hurdles him and knocks him off balance.
What? I missed that.
It's very good. He accidentally tackles Shane by trying to jump over him or to get behind him.
There's also a point I've written down that, like, I can't help but feel like watching this game, Matthew Rees would have been excellent in 1987.
Yes.
He loves a scrap. Like, every single ruck that he enters, he gets a little slap in there or a little bit of a jab at someone's jaw or something. Really subtle, but he just loved to be amongst it.
Also, throwing straight didn't have to be part of your skill set.
Yeah, bless him. He kind of struggled in that area.
I think Steve Walsh only pulls him up on it once in the game.
And it's literally Alan Wynne-Jones has caught it, like,
every single throw is so crooked. It is Alfie levels of not straight. Like, it is absurd. He is, honestly, Australia can feel very hard done by for how few free kicks they got in this game.
Yes. Yeah, it's not a vintage day for Matthew Rees in terms of the line out and so on. But obviously, he's always good around the park and always, always loves a big hit and so on. I also wanted to point out as well, it takes 3 minutes for George Gregan to get told off for back chat in this game. 3 minutes
in. I would
have
thought him and Steve Walsh would get on well.
The first scrum of the game, Steve Walsh says to him, like, nine, please cut out your back chat, it's too much. And it's just vintage George Gregan. What else would you want from him?
That absolutely is. That's perfect. And, I mean, he's also very good. He has such a role in basically everything Australia do.
Yeah.
And that first half hour in particular is interesting because the game doesn't feel unbalanced. It doesn't feel like one team is much better than the other. And yet, Australia pop up several times and just have individual moments of phenomenal skill where several players link up and all look better than their equivalents.
Yes. Yes.
It's like both teams are on a par in terms of, like, stats and whatever, but just the Australian players are better.
Yeah, that's it. And that's and like, really good player who I grew up somewhat idolising, but I've not been impressed with Dwayne Peel so far this tournament.
I have written in my notes, was Dwayne Peel shit?
Yeah, like, I grew up with him as, like, as you remember, like, one of my favourite players. Mm. As, like, the scrum half who goes quickly and, you know, is entertaining to watch and so on. But, and, like, I remember that he was a very good player, right? And was obviously excellent for the Scarlets. Brilliant in the most part for Wales, I believe. But he underperformed against Canada and he was kind of a weak link for Wales today.
Yeah. The amount of times he will carry into contact because there's a slight gap when he's got no support whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's like watching Reece Webb.
Yes, yes. And, like, don't get me wrong, Mike Phillips on the bench did exactly that, but he's physical enough that he won contests. Like,
Yeah.
Dwayne Peel threw so many loose offloads and so on, whereas, like, you contrast that with George Gregan. George Gregan was the master scrum half at just, as you say, controlling the tempo of a game. If they need to play slower, then they will. If he needs to play quicker, then he is absolutely your man.
There's a point where the ball comes loose and Dwayne Peel has a look of panic in his eyes and goes, I've got to do something. I've got to do something quickly. And he just dive passes to no one because that's his instinct when he's worried.
Yeah.
Can you imagine when the Scarlets about to lose a game and he just dives at the floor and chucks his laptop at someone?
Yeah. There's very much that vibe that, like, that's just his default option is to go for a dive pass.
Yeah.
And I'm now realizing I've been criticized for that before.
Is this a classic you hate yourself?
Yeah.
As your therapist.
And I've always, as like a, you know, 11, 12, 13 year old kid, Dwayne Peel was a player I idolized, as I say. Mm. And I'm now realizing that it's answered a lot of questions for me. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. The other problem with the Welsh attack is that it is so flat, it's basically the Australian defence.
Yeah.
Like, you basically can't tell the two apart.
Jesus Christ, it's terrible, the Welsh attack, isn't it?
Like, there's a couple of moments where they get things going and they look good, but they're so flat on each other and so close to the Australian line. You're like, what are you going to achieve here?
Even when they make breaks, they look shit in attack.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when they make, like, half breaks, there's a point where, like, Martin Williams makes a nice line break and, like, links up with, I think it's Shane outside him. And even though it's Shane, you're thinking, like, I know we're not going to score this. Like, nothing's going to come of this because, like, what's the best case scenario? He gets tackled, then we have to try and set something up with a bunch of forwards who look clueless. There's one point, I think it's at the start of the second half, when Shane makes a break, then Wales immediately go to spread it wide. And the first few passes are fantastic. And we start to get it wide. And then in midfield, we find Matthew Rees and Gethin Jenkins together. And both of them don't draw anyone in and throw really shit passes.
Like, really slow, hanging in the air, like, wobbly off-target passes.
Yeah.
Like, one of them needs to be caught on the chest.
And that's it. And, like, at that point, you probably have to accept, like, we're not scoring off this. We just need someone to straighten and just carry and, you know, recycle for the next phase, get quick ball. And Gethin and Matthew Rees both just kind of go, like, no, you know, they just add to the problem by giving it to Mark Jones, who gets pushed into touch.
Mm, exactly. And it's just, he's given no option. Yeah. He's given nothing.
Yeah, it's not Mark Jones' fault at all.
There's another point, like, there's a really good move Wales run where they've got, like, runners out the back and they hit them and they kind of have interlinking two waves of attack. And it's going pretty well. And then they instantly get smashed the moment it gets to any player who's got to make a decision rather than being pre-planned.
Yeah.
And it's like, this was really nice, but it's so clear what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, you've drawn in six people perfectly, but the seventh is always going to nail you.
Yes, yes.
And then, like, the next time they get the ball, they try to run a similar move, but instead they've only got the one wave of attack. And so they throw one great pass, one shoddy pass, and then James Hook chucks it into touch.
Yeah. That's James Hook's first touch of the ball.
Mm.
I was going to bring this up. Like, I think this is a part of why Wales couldn't get into the game, because early on in the game they had to bring off Sonny Parker, so Kevin Morgan came on.
Get stretched off. Yeah. Yes, and so instead of bringing on James Hook, who at the time was primarily playing centre for the Ospreys and had played centre for Wales quite a deal in the Six Nations, instead of bringing him on for Sonny Parker, who was a 12, they bring on Kevin Morgan and move Gareth Thomas into midfield.
Yeah, yeah.
When him and Thomas and Shanklin are both very much 13s when they're playing in the centres.
Yes. Not a lot of hair in that centre combo either.
No.
Then Gareth Thomas goes off injured near the end of the first half and James Hook comes on. And you just think, right, okay, we've not got a backup plan now. Like, we've not got, like, a direct runner in the back line, other than Tom Shanklin, actually. But, like, he can't do it all on his own. We've not got...
And Shanklin's, like, as I say, he's a direct runner, but he's not a Jamie Roberts. He's not a Big Bash Bosh option, is he?
And Gareth Thomas is kind of whatever you want him to be
in this game.
And, yeah, as I say, like, he's a kicking option. He's quick. He's strong. He can do that kind of extra flanker thing. Like, he has a lot of tools for his box, and we lost all of them. And there was just such a sense of hopelessness among the Welsh backline where it was like, oh, shit, we've lost Alfie. Like,
it's constant just, like, shipping on nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, basically every Welsh attack is, you have it, you have it. It's sort of hot potato-y. And eventually it gets to Shane, and he might do something or he might not.
Yeah, yeah. But just, like, James Hook just felt like he was just there to overplay everything. And just, like... Every single time he got the ball, he just threw, like, a long miss pass rather than looking in behind or, you know, doing something simple or boring or going himself, which, surprisingly, you know, as his career went on, he did a lot more of going himself. But, yeah, it was infuriating that the drop-off from Gareth Thomas to James Hook in the midfield. Mm. This is a very young James Hook, I will add. Like, he's very green at this point, like, and I'm sure he came away from this game and learned a lot. But...
And then forgot it again, promptly, a few years afterwards.
But yeah, it was very frustrating watching this Welsh backline, other than Shane Williams. But yes, we'll get on to that.
Yeah.
The Australian backline, however...
Complete night and day difference.
Joy to watch! Holy shit, every time they did anything, even if it wasn't very good, it was so good to watch, because you could see like where they were trying to go, on the, like what they were trying to do all the time. And above all, it's something that I think is so heavily hailed, like... Andy Farrell spoke about this before the Six Nations of 2023 started, that he views the most important thing in attack being work rate, you know, being quick into position, being ready to do something and having people organised around you. I think this Australian team, and the backline in particular, are so built on that because they're so talented that if they just beat their opposite players to space, they will score all the time. And let's talk about Matt Gitto's opening try.
Yeah, glorious. And also... really highlights, I think, the biggest gulf between these two teams. And we've talked about the attack. We'll talk about the defence, no doubt, as we go on. We've talked about the songwriting abilities. But I think the real thing that stands out when you look at these two teams on attack is how good Australia are at clearing out breakdowns.
Yes. From 1
to
15.
Their clean work is phenomenal.
Yes.
And their ball is so much quicker. They are getting right in and smashing out. They're going beyond the ball. They're frequently tying in extra bodies and extra players. And, you know, you could get away with even more than you can nowadays back then because no one was doing it yet. It was really early days in that being a thing of, like, really targeted breakdowns that went beyond the ball.
What's great about that as well, George Gregan does not bother sniping at all in this game. Like, Wales have clearly done their homework on the Japan game, seen that George Gregan set up a load of tries from going himself around the fringes of breakdowns, because that was a big trend for scrum halves around this kind of era of rugby, was that, you know, going for snipes and kind of picking out holes in the defence, right? That was such a big trend. Clearly Wales have done their homework and gone like, let's not give Gregan an inch. So Gregan didn't bother trying to take one. Gregan would just go, okay, I'll just trust this incredible backline I've got outside me. And didn't bother trying to run, which is just the perfect... It's exactly what Australia needed. With such quick ball, like, they were just running the Welsh defenders from side to side and getting them really tired out.
Yeah. And so you end up in a situation where Australia have three rucks in a row working in from one touch line towards the midfield. All of them lightning fast.
Yeah.
All of them, to say at this point, right, like, quick ball was considered 5-6 seconds. Like, the ruck speed was so much higher than it is now. I think it was even higher than that.
Yes.
Like, you consider maybe 7 or 8 seconds quick ball.
Yeah.
But 5 seconds was, like, lightning fast. It was sort of around 2013, the All Blacks started saying, like, 5 seconds was their goal for ruck, for every ruck.
Yeah.
And obviously that's now down to about, like, just under 3 seconds, like 2.5 seconds.
Yeah, I think you look at Ireland, they're looking at about 2.6, 2.7, aren't they?
Yeah. France are often looking just to negate a ruck at all. They're looking to literally place the ball into Dupont's hands. Or offload in the space of a ruck. So Australia generating consistently ball that is going to ground, then into Gregan's hands in maybe 4 seconds, is outstanding at this space. But they're also dragging Welsh defenders in. And you see, by the time they get to the point that the ball comes out to Barnes, Australia have run 3 successive phases that have all not only brought in 3 Welsh players with such speed, a speed they're not used to facing at all. They've also brought extra defenders in, so you've ended up more people around the ruck, even more that would be watching Gregan, and it's left so light that Dwayne Peel, who was previously filling in behind, has had to come in and stand in as basically the position where both you'd want your centre and or centre or fly half, your kind of first back in,
yeah,
and a back rower.
Yes.
And instead the nine is covering both of those roles because he's got to, because he's kind of panicked last second because all the back rowers are on the floor. Really, really good, smart, sharp stuff. Barnes just spots this. He spots that he's coming into position late and he doesn't try to overplay it at all.
No.
He just slides in and it's really lovely by Barnes.
And as I say, like, Gitto is so quick into position on the inside of him that he's such a genuine threat, and Barnes throws the dummy because obviously Wales are marking Gitto instead, and then just draws the fullback and puts Gitto under the sticks. It's so just fantastic, that attack. Like, you're right, like the ruck speed and then the backs doing that justice by going, no, we're going to be clinical, we're going to get into position just as quickly, we're going to give the forwards the treat they deserve for working so hard, we're going to work hard as well.
It's really, really nice. Also, you say Barnes draws the fullback. He does an incredible job because Alfie was very drawn.
Yes, I forgot about this. Yes, yes. Tell me about that.
I mean, Steve Walsh did not enjoy it. Steve Walsh did not have much time for this. As Barnes goes through and he's got Gitto on his inside, Alfie, I think it's fair to call it a flying shoulder.
Yeah. He completely goes like shoulder to upper chest. He's toeing the line, Alfie.
Mm.
And let's face it, nowadays, that's probably a red card.
Yeah, it's a definite top-end yellow.
Yeah.
With possibility of a red that would need a lot of replays in which Carl Dixon would find mitigation and penalise Wales.
Yes. Well after the ball, no arms whatsoever.
Yeah. It's very, very good. All the passion you want from Alfie.
Yeah. But Steve Walsh goes up to him afterwards and says, right, captain, so right there, what you've just done, I can't give it a penalty restart, but that would have been an advantage, but they've gone and scored a try. However, you know what that means for you, though, eh?
I'll see you out tonight, walkabout Cardiff.
Yeah. I was very surprised that he wasn't given a yellow card for that, but clearly it was, you know, anything more and you're off.
Steve Rolls.
Yep, Steve Rolls indeed, Steve Rolls indeed. But yes, that's not long before Gareth Thomas goes off injured. And in fairness as well, we spoke before about Tony Spreadbury and his handling the head situation. Gareth Thomas is rocked by Stirling Mortlock in midfield. Gets like a huge shot of him. And it's clearly his neck to shoulder to head area that is stinging. And Steve Walsh just says, mate, like, don't risk that. Go off. Like, you're done, mate.
Good on him.
And you know what? He was extremely clear about it. He's very empathetic. I don't think it was a concussion, but Steve Walsh clearly just thought, you know, even if it's his neck, that's just as important a thing to look after, you know?
Yeah.
And so said, like, mate, I'm not being funny. Just go off. Like, you can't play on with that. And he couldn't. Like, he walked off. He couldn't jog off. Very unfortunate, but yeah.
Yeah. Australia keep building on that try, though. The kicking of a penalty.
Yeah.
Put them further ahead. Beric Barnes, I think, very clearly in his, this is my shot of the 10 shirt, I've replaced Stephen Larkham, I need to make an impression, goes for a drop goal once they get into 22, which I didn't pay any attention to because we didn't have a commentator. And it wasn't until half time when I kind of saw it go over and I was like, oh, there's a drop goal. And half time, then they played the replay of all the highlights. I was like, oh, wait, no, they kicked the drop goal.
It's a really good one as well. It's a bloody great strike. Like, he absolutely nailed it. Seems like a good decision as well. Like,
just
send
on.
That message to Wales of like, no, you're not getting a slither of momentum here. You've lost your captain. You've got James Hook on and you're 3 points further down. See ya.
What less could you possibly want?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wales just keep faffing in their own half, which is really annoying. Like, you want them to kick the ball downfield, but Dan Vickerman gets a fantastic turnover at one point, like, on the halfway line. And Dan Vickerman, again, like, I think he had an excellent game. Like, whenever Wales, like, got a bit of momentum, he would just ruin it. There was that turnover. There was a couple of really important line-out steals. There was one in his own 22, one in the opposition 22. There was a charge down. He got a Dwayne Peel, which led to a chance. Like, he had such a good game.
Mm. I won't argue with your statement whatsoever. Australia then, tell you what, I'm going to skip ahead to the next try because this is some glorious stuff.
It is some glorious stuff.
We have initially Wales recover the ball off turnover, start to spread it wide, and it looks like this could be on. There could be a chance here. Matthew Rees gets it and dukes outside his man. just jinx his way through. It's like watching Barry John vintage, put him in the 10 shirt. And as he gets outside, he tries to link up, but the pass is dog shit.
Yes, it's terrible. It finds the floor, and also Matt Dunning, who drops on the ball, beautifully scoops up to George Gregan. Mm. Between the two of them, they clean up that mess spectacularly well.
And tell you what, George Gregan, man.
Bloody hell, he's good, isn't he? Like, he's so, so sharp. Like, he knows exactly what to do in every single situation. He still has the gas to get on the outside of a man and then chips it perfectly inside. And it's an absolute beauty.
It isn't a kind of hanging chip for someone to chase. And it isn't a kind of slid grubber through. He just kind of puts it exactly where he wants it and knows the ball will sit up,
yeah,
you know, just by the try line.
Yeah.
And trust, Sterling Moltke chasing will have the pace to beat Matthew Rees, as it was out there. Geoffrey Jenkins is also out there as well. I think Mark Jones is about, but he's on the floor. He's fallen over in the whole process.
Yeah.
And it leaves Mortlock able to recover and score in the corner.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic try.
Everything about it, from an Australian perspective, is just perfect. Like, George Gregan is in the right place at the right time, and yeah, that chip is just delightful. Like, I don't know if there's anybody else in that Australian team who could have put such perfection on that chip.
Yeah. There's another interesting thing that happens about this time, is that the commentators come into the booth.
Right, I was about to play you, so before we do that, here is the commentary on the try. Pretty good, right?
Yes, pretty great. That's really stand out.
And then, yeah, as you say, there then comes a bizarre moment where you're watching this game, and then suddenly you hear this. Inexplicable Frenchman!
I thought they were Russian.
Random French invasion. It seems pretty French to me.
I'm sure they're Russian.
Is it Russian?
They're Russian, yeah.
They're Russian?
Yeah.
Russian commentary.
Possibly a different Russian-derived language. It could be Georgian or something we've talked about in the past. But I'm pretty sure that was Russian.
Wow.
Like, all the words I picked out were Russian words.
Huh. I mean, my Russian's sounded not very Russian. Good. So, either way, random commentary comes in.
No, but at some point they say, "Dart." Someone asked, one of the commentators asked a question, the other one says, "Dart."
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, a little bit of Russian.
Okay. Either way, right, random commentary just starts coming in an inexplicable language for like 10 minutes, then they piss off again.
Yeah, so they come in for the last 10 minutes before half time, they just have a little chat, they're not really talking about the game at all, right? They, in that entire time they're commentating, I'm pretty sure they say one player's name.
Yes.
Which is Shane Williams gets the ball and they say Kevin Morgan. And I think that's the only time they commentate on a player individually.
My theory is that... Is it Fox Sports, I guess, who were running this in Australia?
Channel 10, I think.
Channel 10, that was it, Channel 10. That they forgot to bring their mics for Rupert McCall, Ben Darwin and Ben Tune. That they left all of their mics at home and went, okay, you're just going to have to freestyle it. Just go with no mics. I'm sure they'll be able to hear you, right? And these random two Russian men have just walked in on a room in a pub where those microphones happen to be left over. And then maybe the game's on telly.
Yeah, exactly. Like, something's just gone wrong. They've just had these guys walk in. They're still eating their lunch by the sounds of it. They then go off for half time. They leave for half time. And they clearly take too long a break. And they come back in around the hour mark again and just commentate on 10 minutes of stuff.
Yeah,
I like they're clearly paid by the game rather than by the minute.
Yeah, it's very strange, that situation, and I couldn't figure out what the situation was with the commentary or anything. Like, on the Bundaberg halftime rap, they showed Rupert McCall's face and he was just miming, like he was speaking but no words were coming out, no noise was leaving his mouth, and I really wanted to know what he was having to say on the Bundaberg halftime rap.
I was really, really wondering what Rupert McCall had to say about Barrick Barnes' drop goal.
Yeah.
But we'll never know.
We had to Instead, watch it in silence.
Instead, we will know an awful lot about those two Russian men having a little chat.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think he was saying? I think you should replace what was not being said, and you should make a canon what he was saying at halftime.
Yes, Rupert McCall, yeah. The Russian
Rupert McCall. Rupert McCall.
Rupert McCall. Well, the thing is, right? You know what we all know about Rupert McCall, right? He was named Rupert McCall because he had a destiny to become a commentator, but his true real dream was to be a pioneer of electronic music.
Okay, what's he now?
Yes, he spent the entire halftime show. You had alongside him, do you have any pundits?
Ben Tune and Ben Darwin.
Ben Tune and Ben Darwin, thank you. He was constantly turning to Ben Tune and going, you know, your name, Ben Tune, just reminds me, it brings me back to my days when I was trying to pioneer ambient and new age genres of music within Australian and European fields. I thought it was a very, very exciting time in music. You know, I wanted to try and use jazz traditions, but in a more new age electronic fashion.
You like and jazz? That's what Ben Tune said back to
me. It's at this point, Ben Tune pipes in and says, so do you like Jean-Michel Jarre?
And then Ben Darwin then comes in and starts talking about Darwinism.
Yeah.
That's his favourite thing.
Ben Tune, this entire time, was trying to get a radio to be on the right station. But instead he was picking up a Russian station. He couldn't Ben Tune it right.
Stop telling me about natural selection. I want to get this radio right.
I think this is how all commentary teams should work.
Yes, yes.
I don't know what a Mullins is.
We're strong believers in nominative determinism, aren't we?
Yeah. I don't know what a Mullins is. But I tell you, no, he's always mulling over the news, isn't he?
Go. We have to end this bit. We have to.
It's not going anywhere.
No.
Though I am very, very glad that Eddie took some time out from looking after that house in order to give us his wonderful commentaries.
Yes, I agree. Do you think he's related to Alfred the?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
He was actually his predecessor.
Yes. Okay, fair enough. My last note on the first half is, lol, Wales are getting bummed.
Funny you should say that. At one point, you can hear a Welsh player in a ruck, right? And they shout, leave me alone, you knobber. Which is a gloriously 2007 knobber. Insult. Knobber.
Wow. Knobber.
Knobber.
That's a proper, like, we've not had the in-betweeners yet, so we don't quite know what discourse to make up to insult people, young people.
But that's like, I remember people saying knobber.
I've
like,
never heard knobber before.
Yeah, it wasn't popular.
No.
It was some people would say
clearly
it
I'm not a knobber and you are, whatever
no.
it means.
Maybe it was far Welsher slang.
Maybe so.
Yes, I was a knobber.
Yeah.
I wonder if Urban Dictionary's got a definition for it. But I think the very important thing was that had Pagrail, and they were like grown men.
Yeah,
they were
yeah.
grown men calling strangers knobbers.
Yeah. There is something great about when you've not got commentary, hearing the insults and stuff that's going on the field. Also, the amount of come on Shane I heard when there was no commentary. Like, so many crowd members and probably players shouting go on Shane every
yes.
time he got the ball or was anywhere near the ball.
He took a high ball and someone shouted, well done, Shane.
I heard someone shout, give it to Shane, like when they had comment. And it's like, that's something that you kind of joke about. But no, there's a lot of that being shouted as well.
So,
but yeah, I did hear somebody insult, like calling someone a wanker or something. But yeah.
From 2004 on Urban Dictionary, an entry saying a knobber is someone that has just done something incredibly stupid.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting.
But there's also another definition from 2007 saying someone that should be backhanded for being a dick.
Okay. Well, we're in that era, the 2004-2007, the knobber era, as this is known.
That was the World Cup cycle, yes.
Yeah,
collectively, it was known as the knobber era.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure there's a coach called Knobber who was in charge of Wales at some point in that era as well, but I can't remember.
But I thought that was an interesting thing that an adult man said.
Yes, absolutely.
It's probably the sort of thing Ollie Barkley will write about in his column.
Exactly. As long as his missus isn't around.
She's in the basement, tied up.
Stays away from the keyboard when his missus is around. So The reason why I wrote LOL Wales are getting bummed is because Chris Latham scores a try, and it's just like, oh my god, like, we are terrible.
That try is absurd.
Yeah.
It's one of these, right, where if you're watching it as a Welsh type, all you can focus on is how poor the defence is, because you'd be right.
Yeah. But
then you see it a second time, and you're like, oh no, it's a really good try.
Yeah, it's really
just
good.
The defence is also shit.
So, it starts with George Smith carrying the ball, and the thing you said about quick rucks and what France are doing... George Smith does that tactic, and even though he has players rucking over him, he doesn't just pop the ball off the floor. He basically puts it over his head and throws it towards Ducouré. And after this, Ducouré throws a really poor pass that hits the floor and just bobbles on the floor and stuff. And it's just irrelevant.
Matt Gitter bounce pass.
Yes. But things, it's irrelevant because their speed ball's so quick. Wales are still on the retreat. There's nothing they can do about one error that Australia do. And... I say that, I'm giving the stuff before Ducouré's pass a lot of credit. But, Matt Gitto!
He's very, very
good. He's unreal! His pickup of that pass off the floor, like off his toes, and then in half a second adjusting and lobbing an absolute pinpoint pass to Drew Mitchell on the wing, who streaks down. It completely foxes out the entire Welsh back line. It's just fantastic.
There are six passes thrown in the sequence. Four of them are offloads. And all of them basically wonderful miracle offloads.
Yeah.
Like, the two last offloads that get it into the space and eventually into Latham's hands are incredible.
Yeah.
Right? Yet the most impressive bit is one of those two passes that wasn't, which is the Gitto pickup and delivery of a perfect pass.
Absolutely. It's genuinely insane, like, Matt Gitto's skill level here. He's just one of the perfect, like... almost touch rugby players. Like, he spots the space and he knows exactly how to get it there. It's just a beauty. And yeah, as you say, like, Mitchell and gets it inside. And Latham finishes. Really strong finish by Latham.
Yeah.
Can't really argue with it. And then, yeah, Australia going 25-3 up at half time.
Contrast that to when Wales try an offloading movement and it's James Hook throws it at Shane Williams' face, who tries to offload it, but it lands on his own head and accidentally bounces off his head onto Sterling Morlock's head, and Australia turn it over.
It's very telling.
Whereas Australia run this beautiful, beautiful flowing move, with Matt Gitto being this effortless linchpin that results in Latham scoring in the corner.
Yeah, yeah. Australia, this backline is basically infallible at this point against this defence. Wales do, not long after half-time though, get a bit of a positive... Let me tell you, before we talk about this try, Jonathan Thomas loves a pirouette.
So, Jonathan Thomas, I always thought this when he was a player, and seeing him do it again now, him playing number eight, he carries the ball off the back of a scrum like a player driving for the line 1 inch out. Like, he's going to make
drops
a really
to the deck
hard-earned...
quickly, yeah.
Like, he kind of carries very low, very much charges at the midriff, hoping to make, like... an inch further than he should.
Yeah.
Instead of charging to kind of, you know, knock people off balance.
Yes.
And so, when Wales get within close to the line, that's actually quite a useful skill to be well practiced in.
Yeah. And they have a decent little build-up, like Hook nearly scores. That's how good a build-up it was.
Yeah.
Stephen Jones puts him in a bit of space. Like, Stephen, I think, manages his attack pretty well. Shane Williams pops up at 9 and at 10, like, a few times and does very well. And then eventually, yeah, they get to the pick and go. They have a few good ones. And then eventually, yeah, JT's in the right place at the right time and drives over. Jonathan Thomas gets on the scoreboard. I should also say, the reason why they got into this situation in the first place is straight after that shit Matthew Rees and Gethin Jenkins pass sequence. As soon as Australia get the ball back, Gethin Jenkins wins a fantastic breakdown turnover.
Mm.
And it's like, you know what, fair play. He's just made a really terrible mistake and backed it up with a really good jackal and gets him into the territory where they do actually score.
Yeah. Stephen Jones also makes a great turnover as well.
Weird that, isn't it?
Which is, yeah.
It's very good. Gets involved in the breakdown a little bit. Very strange.
Did you also think the try was scored by Alwyn Jones?
Yes. I wrote down Alwyn Jones try, crossed it out and wrote JT.
Yes, I did the same. I wrote AWJ try. Oh, wait, it's JT.
Yeah. We did the same thing. Yeah, Australia getting to Welsh 22 straight afterwards in what is canonically known as a coach killer.
Yes.
When Dwayne Peel, tries to clear the ball and gets charged down by Vickerman. And George Smith, bloody he can carry, man. Like, we've not really spoken about it. He gets a really good jackal on Alan Wynn earlier in the game as well. Like, he's just everywhere, like, and he's not overly showy. Like, this is probably one of his quiet games for Australia, is the mad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you don't notice him until he does something incredible.
Yes.
It's not like he's all over the pitch.
Yeah. And Australia are attacking with such pace in the 22 that Shane Williams is caught offside two phases in a row. That's the quickest player. The most likely to be able to get back and then get off the line again is caught offside two phases in a row.
They're attacking with such force and vigour and inevitability that they kick the goal from the penalty. And you go, what are you doing? Like, I get building a scoreboard and like, oh, clean start and we've just conceded and everything. But you're completely on top. And you're at this point, what was it, 15 points ahead?
Yeah. The one thing that isn't going well for Australia is goal kicking. Like, they've missed like three or four shots at goal and they're absolutely tearing the defence apart. There is a Mortlock Dick of the Day nomination to come out of this, to be fair.
Because that's the thing, right? Sterling Mortlock is the captain and goal kicker, which is a classic power complex thing. He's the 13. He shouldn't be either of those things.
Yeah.
And he takes a shot at goal for himself. He's like, I want points. I want points for me. I want a full house. I want to do this. Beric Barnes has got the drop goal, so it's already ruined for him. And he misses.
Yes. In fairness, even after he goes off, they're still doing this. So it's not just Mortlock's issue. Because
Wales then get into the other half after he misses. And they go, you know what? That's a really good idea. Let's kick for goal. Wales are 15 points down. And they kick for goal.
It's
with bloody James Hook taking it.
It's one of those, the James Hook killer ones as well, that's just next to the posts.
Yeah.
Like, that's his favourite one to miss.
I did not expect him to get it for a moment.
Honestly, I was off the edge of my seat there.
He somehow nails it, though he does shortly afterwards, Wales get another penalty. They're now only 12 points behind, so obviously Hook goes for it again from basically halfway. And obviously he scuffs it, and the ball gets cleared. There's a bit of a kicking back and forth. They put up a bomb, and guess who's underneath it? But the one, the only, Stephen Jones, the safest pair of hands in the Welsh team. The man you'd want to take everything, to be in a high-pressured situation. You know, the guy you feel you can trust the most in that entire side. Mm-hmm. And it goes really well. He recovers the ball, he kicks it back.
It does, yeah, it's fantastic. Brilliant by Stephen Jones. Yeah, kicks it back and nothing else happens. Why'd you ask?
That joke is only for us because no one else remembers this game well.
I'll tell you what, like, in the hypothetical world where Stephen Jones drops that ball and Chris Latham goes the distance, in that hypothetical world, which isn't this one, right? Okay. By the way, it's weird that at one point when they scored the another try that they were rewarded 14 points for it rather than 7, isn't it? Weird that, that's isn't weird. It? Very strange.
This is their last try.
Yeah, but one of the early ones, isn't it?
Right, okay, of course, yeah. So Wales were 22 points behind. Is what
Yeah. Thank you for the correction. But yeah, anyway, in the hypothetical world where the alternate universe where Stephen Jones drops this ball, right, I feel really sorry for him because it's like, oh yeah, well, he's, you know, such, as you say, such a safe pair of hands, right? And also because, like, I looked at this, I went, fucking hell, James Hook, do something useful. What are you doing, man? Like, you're there at fullback. You're supposed to be, like, filling the boots of Gareth Thomas. You couldn't lace that man's boots, man. Like, you're there. You're in the wrong position. You've overrun the ball. It's not that good a kick. Latham's read it so much better than you. You're shit, mate. And then I see the reverse angle go at Stephen Jones. I go, oh, Steve-o, mate. Oh, I'm so sorry. That's unlucky. Yeah. That's unlucky, pal. See you next week.
I was largely the same. It's funny how narrative shapes your view, doesn't it?
Yeah. But good thing was, yeah, it was Stephen Jones, not James Hook. And he caught the ball and he just kicked it back. No issues.
Yeah, so it wasn't a
nothing
problem.
Nothing to see here. I don't want to talk about it. Jesus fucking Christ, James Hook. That was actually in Stephen Jones' body.
Stephen Jones. Fucking he just completely misjudges it. Just like jumps in the wrong place, arms all over the place. It's terrible. Yeah. Australia get their bonus point in, which they seem desperate not to get. The moment they get the third try, they're like, cool, great, let's back up there.
Yeah. Oh, what's that? Three try bonus point. Oh, cheers for informing us, Wales. Cheers, lads.
They have another nailed on try they're about to score, where they do some lovely handling, get it out to Drew Mitchell, who then goes, nah, I'm going myself, when he's got two men on his inside who are definitely scoring if he gives the pass.
What a tackle by Kevin Morgan, though.
Yeah, full credit to Kevin Morgan, man.
It's fantastic.
Man.
It's so
completely
good.
Commits, nails him.
It's not just body on the line, Lee Harpenstall. his technique is so good.
And, and he's never is.
Yeah. But like, he dislodges the ball and Shane has a bit of a run off the back of it. Like, fantastic by Kevin Morgan. So phenomenal. Good when you're 30-odd points down or whatever. Like,
it's one of those that you want to show kids.
Yeah.
You know, like, not for them to learn from, just in general.
Yeah, just any kid.
You just want to pull kids over and just go,
all right, lads, here's a video.
How you doing? How you doing?
It's a video. He's called Kevin.
It's Kevin Morgan. I hate him. There's never been a good person called Kevin.
First the Keiths and now the Kevins.
I forgot I said Keith and not Kevin.
Well, you think that all Keiths are stupid and you hate everyone called Kevin.
I want this bit to end at the end of this episode. I do not want this to continue.
Okay. We won't publish this but and put it out as a podcast for hundreds the rest of thousands, if not fucking millions of people to listen to.
That's true. That if you were to look at kind of the Venn diagram of people that went to Jean-Michel Jarre concerts and people listen to this podcast, same.
Yeah, they're like, all the
same listenership.
I think we know, are same numbers of people. More popular than Jean-Michel Jarre. It's close. Yeah, right? It's close.
He never hired people to put headphones on, you know, on other people and just walk around
and
with
if,
them.
If he is more popular than this podcast, then it's not by much. It's marginal. It's by like
a few million.
Few hundred. Yeah. Millions. Billions. Maybe. Yeah.
Like, I reckon similar numbers are listening to us on Spotify.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, similar. Yeah. Similar in that they're both numbers.
Yeah.
Like, they're not close, like, numerically, but they're similar numbers.
They are numbers, yeah.
They are numbers. Similar numbers. Like, if you were to write them down, your brain would look at them both and go, oh, numbers.
Yeah, like Jiffy.
You know, like, 8 and...
Yeah, it's a number.
You know, 300 million. I think they're similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm glad we got to the bottom of that. Drew Mitchell does a tip tackle on Matthew Rhys and gets yellow carded for it.
Yeah. Which I kind of missed. And I was like, what's... Because he was kind of... Steve was giving like a repeat infringements thing. And you're like, wait, why have you binned him the
yeah.
And like, oh, right, okay, there was a... Fine.
What on earth did Nathan Sharp get yellow carded for?
I could have told you at the time, but I couldn't now. No, because I didn't write that down.
Because I just saw him get yellow carded and I was like, wait, what the hell? Like, Wales were just held up over the try line. Where's the penalty come from? So I really couldn't figure that out.
He was offside. He was offside for the tackle.
Oh, okay, fair enough. It made up for my confusion of earlier in the game when Kevin Morgan did this chip kick downfield. Latham takes him out. That Steve Walsh goes and talks to the touch judge about it. Goes, right, okay, penalty where it lands. And yellow card, I guess? And they're like, okay, yeah, sure. And then he gives the kind of yellow card to Chris Latham where you don't actually bring the yellow card out your pocket and you don't send him to the sideline for 10 minutes. You say, yeah, all right, just get back to fullback. Don't do that again. It's like a football-style yellow card, you know?
Tell you what, right, Rocky Elsom has a phenomenal moment where Kevin Morgan pumps it long on turnover. And they've got him, Shane Williams, James Hook all chasing. And Elsom is the only guy back, somehow recovers it and beats both of them.
Yeah, yeah. And gets an offloading as well. I think that's the same incident, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, Elsom's work rate's ridiculous.
One of those players that just creates moments, yes. Rocky Elsom.
Yes, he's so good. He's so good. Really good leader. Great carrier. Yeah, the lot. Can we just briefly talk about Wales? Suddenly, their attack has been absolutely dog shit all game. There is one moment where it's suddenly incredible, where they run this really weird set play thing, where it was like a two-phase move, and the second phase had Shane stood in at 10, and 9 would loop around Shane. James Hook would run this weird curved angle outside him with Kevin Morgan on the inside running it, and Shane did this beautiful chip over the top, and Wales are suddenly like 50 metres upfield, and it's like, wait, lads, why are we good now?
You know what the thing they were missing is, don't you?
Shane.
No, Duncan Jones on the wing.
Duncan Jones on the wing was fantastic. He was like permanently on there, like it's like an edge forward.
Yeah.
The most
Duncan Jones
edge
gets
forward.
The ball on the wing twice.
Yeah, it's great.
And both times makes at least 5 or 6 metres.
Yeah, it's great. I love the one where him and Gethin do a 1-2.
Yes.
They're both panicking and they're like near the try line. They're just doing this really weird, like, it's like two like under 10s players who are best friends. And it's like, yeah, I'll pass to you when I get it.
It's very, Duncan Jones' stats in this game must be the highest of his career. Because it was probably like, what, 3 carries for 15 metres.
Yes. Yeah. Also, can we just talk about, like, Nugget is absolutely everywhere when Wales become good.
Yeah, he's taking all the
quick taps and like playing scrum half. Like, because Mike Phillips is on at this point, so basically they swap Nugget to nine and put Phillips at flanker.
The better Wales get, the better Nugget gets.
Yes.
Martin Williams for anyone, you know.
Yes.
Otherwise confused. And it's not the other way around. It's not when Nugget gets good, Wales get good.
No.
Because Nugget has a pretty good game, I think, all round.
Yes.
But the moment Wales start playing well, which is literally the moment they're against 13 men.
Yeah.
To be fair, actually, there's a few good passages against 14. But it's when they're against 15 it's a problem.
Yes.
Nugget just keeps growing and growing and growing as his chance to shit out on fewer men gets greater. You know, if there's only 13 of them, he can shit out on each of them to a greater kind of condensation. Like, there's more shit. If we were to do a massive shit and it landed on 15 people,
okay,
each person I've has less that, shit yeah. on them, then we'll discuss that another time. Then if he did it on 13 people, but it was the same size shit.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what's motivating him, I think.
Great analogy, man. Well done.
Thank you.
There's a point where, like, Nugget takes a quick tap and gives it to Mike Phillips on the crash ball. And the mad thing is that's the correct way around to do that.
Yeah. We also, so the great thing that happens right at the end is Wales spend a bunch of time looking really good in attack. Then they get up the try line and it's terrible.
Oh my God, the amount of panic.
And yeah, they've got no composure, no chill whatsoever, no idea what they're going to do, how they're going to execute this, how they're going to actually get over those final few meters, those final few inches, having made up the first 80 quite easily.
I've got a really good idea of how to make for up those last few inches.
Well, this is the thing, right? So Shane Williams, Wales' all-time top try scorer, was my all-time favourite player up until he started doing commentary. And I felt I'd seen, you know, almost all of, if not all of, his tries for Wales.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I knew them, I'd seen them. I, therefore, know normally when we start watching a game if Shane scores on it, because I've watched so many highlights compilations, I'm so kind of, such a former Shaneologist.
Yes. No, 100%, I agree. I'm very much following what you're saying here.
And so, turns out, the last 5 minutes of this game have a Shane Williams try that I've never seen. And with good reason.
Yeah, that because is the shittiest dog shit. Try of Shane Williams' career. Is literally what I have written in my notes. When you say about, like, Wales put strung together this really good phase of attack. Like, they get up to the try line. It's like, it's fluid. It's fast. They've got forwards and backs both handling the ball brilliantly. And then they get up to the try line and they just completely panic and have no idea what to do. As I say, Gethin and Duncan doing a 1-2 to each other and so on. Like, and then you reach a point where it's like, okay, I know exactly what we need to make up this last 5 inches. I've got a genius plan. Let's have Michael Owen, who no one knew was on the field, come on for a random mispass to Matt Gitto, one of Australia's best players, for him to just drop and Shane Williams to just fall on it by accident.
You've missed a key step here, what? Right? So yeah, Michael Owen goes this really floated pass. Well, like, he's trying to...
Michael Owen's on the pitch, by the way.
Yeah, no one knew. Wearing 18, so I was like, is this a prop?
Yeah.
Who is this?
Literally, I looked at him, I was like,
he looks like Michael Owen. He looks like our father, Michael Owen.
Who's this guy? Who's Wales number 18? Who are you? Are you a rugby player? Like, what are you doing on the pitch?
So he goes to throw this really, like, he's clearly going to throw the really wide ball to Shanklin, who's outside Shane Williams, right on the touchline. He's trying to throw that. He gets 3 men too few because it goes straight into Gitto's hands. He recovers it, goes like, I can't believe you just did that. Drops it. He just drops the ball. Shane Williams knocks it on and then it falls, fumbles forward over the line where he drops on it. But because of the TMO laws at the time, the TMO can only comment on the grounding. You know, he can't comment anything before the goal line. So even though Shane has just knocked, Gitto's knocked it on, then Shane's knocked it on, the try is awarded to Shane.
Michael Owen, or whoever it was that was just wearing a Wales shirt that had 18 on the back. There was just somebody on the pitch. Who was that, right? We're presuming it's Michael Owen going by the team sheets, right? But just some guy on the field was, as you say, 3 men too few and the wrong team is pass. Shane Williams, that contributes to Shane Williams's record of being like, what is he, almost level with David Campese in the all-time top try scorers? He's one or two short of David Campese, is he?
To be fair, we've talked about Campese scoring some terrible tries on this podcast.
That's true.
But like, don't hold that against him.
But, like, That contributes to Shane Williams' try record.
But, like,
it's terrible.
Shane Williams is one of three players in the history of the game who has a Wikipedia page dedicated to every try he ever scored.
Which is fantastic. So that's right? on there.
That's one of them.
That's one of them.
That is one of them.
That's 1/60th of his international tries.
That was his 32nd try for Wales.
And safely his shittest.
Yes. Maybe we should do that one day. Once we've done the 87 Premiership, the Carly Rae Jepsen albums.
Yeah.
We've done all the Rugby League World Cups.
Carly Rae Jepsen
we've done
albums
Fisher
on
Mania.
There?
Yeah, it is now.
Okay. Steve Walsh
we've
games.
We've done Steve Walsh games.
Whose movies was it we were doing? Reese Witherspoon?
Reese Witherspoon movies. We did Fisher Mania, obviously. We're
yeah,
going to go through
yeah,
all
yeah. Of. Big time. All I of think the Zimbabwe and qualifying.
The Zimbabwe qualifying. Yeah, African qualifying for the 2007 Rugby World Cup.
Yeah.
Once we've watched the Uruguayan leagues back, I think we should do that. We should go through every Shane Williams try and rank them.
Okay, yeah. From best to shittest. In fact, no, we'll go from shittest to best. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone knows the best ones. It's fine.
Yeah.
So that's terrible, but apparently it's worth 5 points.
Obviously, James Hook missed the conversion, though.
No, yeah. Don't be stupid. I don't need to say that. Everyone knows that.
So he misses it, right? And Wales immediately remain class and attack
yeah,
off the
yeah,
kickoff.
Yeah. It's Duncan Jones on the wing, man. Makes a difference.
I know. He's so valuable.
Making impact. He's still there.
But there's a few moments of Shane being majestic and just, like, glorious in this game. And Mark Jones as well, I think, has a good game, but is often given no ball. Like, there's a few times he's given passes where either the pass has already gone into touch by the time it gets there, or he's just like, what do you want me to do
yeah.
with this?
I think Mark Jones, in the two Wales games we've watched, has set a record for most forward passes collected of anybody
yes.
ever seen that aren't given. Like, he's had to overrun and catch balls that are in front of him more than anybody else. I don't know if that's a reflection on Tom Shanklin or what. Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, though, right? Shane Williams, he's bloody great, isn't he, right?
He's really good.
There is no great... We've just talked about something terrible that he happened to finish, right? And
yeah, he still scored, didn't he?
Yeah, he still scored, right? There's no greater testament in this game to how bloody great he is than when Wales do this quite nice attack, you know, that they get it on the outside. The ball goes from Kevin Morgan's hands through to James Hook's. And then James Hook, you know, does a pretty trademark move of his and passes to the floor.
Yes.
And the ball just goes along the floor and it's horrible. And Shane Williams just picks it up and is just like, oh, okay, yeah, I can just step around everybody now. It's not a problem.
Yeah. Did you want to score from this?
Yeah.
Like, cool, I can get us most of the way.
Yeah.
We can just
and like steps inside Latham and does this brilliant offload to Martin Williams. It's like, weirdly, Shane's pickup and just clearing up of James Hook's mess there is so good that you almost think Wales are going to score if not for the fact that Mike Phillips forgets he's playing rugby for a moment.
That's the yeah, so Wales get into the 22, and if they score this, they're at least getting a losing bonus point out of this game.
Yeah.
And they look nailed on to score it, except yeah. Mike Phillips picks the ball up, he has that typical Mike Phillips thinking about it for a few seconds, and then he just throws the worst pass.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't know, he picks the wrong option, he delivers it badly.
With 1 minute left, like.
Yeah, and it just gives the ball straight back to Australia.
Yeah. And yeah, the game doesn't go on much longer.
My last note is Phillips, no, shut up, in all caps.
My last one is Phillips pass sort of intercepted-ish, I don't know. Full-time Wales flattered.
Yeah. Wales are good for 10 minutes of this game.
Yeah.
Like, they are solid for the last 10 minutes when they're against no one, and they are competent for the first 12 minutes before they have to defend.
Yes.
And everything in between is terrible. Australia are good enough, right? And this was the other big team in their pool.
Yeah.
This was the kind of big clash. This was being sold as one of the highest tier tickets, hence the prices. You know, this was being billed as very much one of the biggest clashes of the World Cup. Australia, I think they were less standout than they were against Japan.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think
Australia were fine.
The performance was referred to as satisfactory by their coach and captain.
Yeah, they were fine. They were all right. And they got a bonus point win without the opposition getting a sniff of a try bonus point.
And I'd say,
only really looking any good once you went down to 13.
Perfectly adequate Wales team. Like, this is probably the strongest team they could have picked. And yeah, there we are.
Like, at this point, you've basically confirmed you're cruising through on perfect points.
Yeah.
In the pool stage.
Yeah.
Like, Australia there have just booked themselves into the best tier quarterfinal. They look sorted. They look fine. Easy. They look grand.
Easy. Yeah. Should we look at Man of the Match Dick of the Day then?
We should. We should. We should.
Where do you want to start? Should we start Dick of the Day?
Okay. Someone that I have in Man of the Match contention is Gareth Jenkins for bringing Kevin Morgan on instead of James Hook when Asenda went off injured. Because I think that was a great move. But ultimately, really he did down. Still bring James Hook on early.
Yeah, that's true.
And you could have put Mike Phillips in the centre.
Duncan Jones, man.
You could have put Duncan Jones King. On the wing.
Yeah.
You could have put Michael Owen on for his hands.
Yeah.
You could have put Alex Popham on at fullback.
Lots of options. Loads and loads of them.
Yeah. And ultimately, he did still put James Hook on. I think that's a Dick of the Day worthy idea. You've got Alan Wynne-Jones for accidentally tackling Shane by trying to hurdle him.
I had down, by the way, Alan Wynne-Jones for the fact that at one point he jumped really confidently for a kickoff and was nowhere near the ball. The ball just went straight over his head and bounced into an Australian's hands.
He makes a break at one point. He just puts his head down and goes.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Which is always a rare sight that I enjoy. Yeah. But honestly, like, it's not a nice one. It's not a good one. But my dick of the day is Dwayne Peel for being shit.
Okay, fair enough.
Sometimes and I was just kind of like, I don't have a nomination, you know. Like, it felt cruel to pick on Stephen Jones when he had a really good game and he dropped one high ball. And everyone else is kind of a bit all over the place. But Dwayne Peel, I just felt really viscerally disappointed watching him all the time.
I know what you mean.
Because he kept, like, his skills were really good, but he kept taking just such poor decisions.
Yeah.
I felt like I was watching the Scarlets first half of the season. He was
uncharacteristically bad for James for Dwayne Peel.
That's it. Like, it was just it was one of those performances where I know this wasn't the case because I watched Dwayne Peel play enough and I've watched him play, you know, retrospectively as well. Where I was like, oh, was he just bad?
Yeah.
Did we just overrate him because we were desperate for a scrum half? Or did he have one burst of form in 2005 that he then never lived up to? And I don't think that was the case. No. I think he just had a really bad game.
Yeah, I think
But it made me question my beliefs.
We did this in 1987 with, like, Michael Liner, bear in mind, when we first watched him play.
Yeah. Matt Gallagher's dad as well.
Yes, exactly.
So, like, I don't like to give it, but I didn't have anyone else.
Yeah, exactly. And that's fair enough.
There was, like, a genuine sinking feeling in seeing him play back.
Yes. No, I had exactly the same thing.
As a player, as you say, we both enjoyed greatly as children.
Yes, absolutely. I've got down Mark Jones for, at one point, he goes for a kick and completely misses the ball with his foot.
Wait a second, I've got James Hooks playing. Why didn't I give it to James Hook? Sorry, please continue.
I just wanted to leave that with you for a moment. There's an interviewer who is unnamed. He interviews Stephen Jones at the end of the game and goes like, oh yeah, you know, what went wrong with today with Wales? And then he was like, oh, you know, we just weren't as good as Australia. Like, you know, their forwards bullied us. You know, their backline were really good. Scored a load of tries past us. You know, our defence needs to be a lot better. And then goes, yeah, but there was that individual error you made, isn't there? And it's like, oh, Jesus Christ, mate. Like,
wow. Talk
about kicking a man when he's down. So, ultimately, my dick of the day is James Hook for dropping that ball that Stephen Jones dropped.
Here's the thing, right? I've had a lot of time to reflect on what I just did. I've had a lot of time to really think about the errors I've made as a person. And I want to begin by apologising to Dwayne Peel. I want to say that I was wrong. I was incorrect. I was disappointed in your performance. And I expected better of you. But also, this was 15 years ago and I've moved on. You've moved on. And so, I'm going to change my dick of the day to be James Hook.
So we've both given James Hook dick of the day for something he didn't do.
For no reason. I mean, he did chuck the ball into touch on his first touch. Yeah, you know, true. Like, he wasn't good, was he?
Yeah, he's far from it. All right, fair enough. Meeting adjourned.
I feel like I've committed the Dwayne Peel thing. I talked for long enough.
Okay,
I don't know. I'm going to give them both dick of the day. I'm allowed.
All right, yeah, go on then. I won't stop you from doing that. Man of the match. I'm going to just quickly rattle through these because I'm talking for a while. One of them I've got written down is Dan Vickerman. He was fantastic. As I say, like, got turnovers at crucial times. Just really solid second row. For the record, I have no Welsh players written down for Man of the Match, and I have no Australian players written down for Dick of the Day.
I think Nugget was not a contender for... He wasn't Man of the Match contention, but I think as well as his best player.
Agreed. Man of the Match for me absolutely has to be Matt Gitto. He is just superior to anything that Wales could possibly throw in his way. Takes his try very well, runs a good line, throws some absolutely blinding passes, kicks really well. We've not really talked about that, but like his kicks in behind were so good other than the one he kicked dead. Yeah, Matt Gitto's man of the match. I just love him.
So yeah, I was similarly entirely focused on Australia as far as man of the match. I know we've primarily talked about Wales in this game, but I mean, Jean-Michel Jarre was a real contender for me as well. I thought he was excellent.
John Smith agrees.
But I think Sterling Mortlock had a really good first half, then obviously came off early in the second half. Could have kept that up. You know, we could have seen something there. And I thought Berrick Barnes, again, really solid, really tidy, like unfussy. And there weren't standout moments except for the Gitto try, but I thought it was very good. But for me, it was kind of a two-horse race between Matt Gitto and George Gregan.
Okay.
And I think Gregan was just like, everything he did correctly. Yeah. Whereas I felt like Gitto would, whereas Gregan was in the game a lot and consistently taking right options, Gitto was turning up and having huge match-changing, game-turning actions, having things that had enormous consequences for the context of the game, which was quite loose and quite even for a lot of the run of it, even if Wales were terrible whenever they had a chance to do something with it, and Australia were great when they did. So it's a really difficult one. Do I go for the player that's more, that was, I felt was better throughout the run of the game, or the player that had the bigger impact on the scoreline? And I think I would have gone for Gitto if you hadn't, but we've gone for the same option too often, so I'm going to have to.
I was going
to
say that. I didn't want to influence you.
So I'm going to go for George Gregan.
Fair enough.
Going to chalk up another one.
Cool.
Putting him, again, up the leaderboard and now level with Scott Lawson.
Yes.
And Akapusi Angera, but mostly Scott Lawson on the player of the tournament rankings.
It's amazing the power of having guests on.
Mate, Forward of Prayer is cleaning this up. So thank you very much for all of the rugby. I hope you are having a really lovely time, and you greatly enjoyed all of the Jean-Michel. I talked about it enough, I should know his name. Jean-Michel Jarre chat, one of my favourite genres of rugby podcast. You don't get this on bloody Big Jim and Goody, do you?
No, you don't.
Not enough chat of French New Wave composers, but there should be.
Yeah, not
and
yet.
And there will be more, no doubt, next week when we will be covering New Zealand against Portugal. A 100-point encounter.
Yeah, Portugal really showed up.
We'll see you then. Until then, have a lovely week. And I hope you have lots of friends that you spend it with, and they are kind to you. And we will see you then. Goodbye.
My Instagram DMs are open if you change your name to Andrew Rieu. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.